You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
Should the U.S. government force young women to register for the draft or stop forcing young men to do so? Edward Hasbrook is a longtime member of the War Resisters League and maintains one of the most comprehensive websites about the Selective Service, the draft, draft registration, and draft resistance. You can check it out at resisters.info. Edward Hasbrook was one of 20 people who were prosecuted for organizing resistance to draft registration in the 1980s, and he spent 4.5 months in a federal prison camp as a result. Ed Hasbrook, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you for having me on, David.
It's great to have you on. Before we turn to what's on the agenda now in Congress and in the world of activism, what happened in the 1980s and what was the success story there?
It's a fairly unknown success story and forgotten even by a lot of the people who were involved even then. What had happened was that after the Vietnam War, the strength of opposition to both the war and the draft was strong enough to get even draft registration completely ended for a five-year period from 1975 to 1980. Draft registration was resumed in 1980 at the end of the Jimmy Carter administration, when Carter was trying to show that he was sufficiently militarist in response to the Iranian Revolution, the so-called hostage crisis. He was during the campaign against Ronald Reagan, and he was trying to show that he could be as tough as Reagan could be. That's a hard bill to follow, isn't it?
Yeah. Reagan, who was cutting deals with the Iranian hostage takers, but that's another story.
So the stated reason, at that time, Carter proposed and Congress agreed to bring back draft registration. The stated reason was in case we needed to deploy large numbers of U.S. troops to Afghanistan on the side of, guess which side we were fighting on then, we were supporting the so-called Mujahideen, as they were called then, who were the people who went on to christen themselves the Taliban and Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, to be clear, Edward, I have many veterans on this show. When you use the term we, you're referring to a criminal enterprise you were resisting and going to prison in opposition to, right?
Well, I refer to the U.S. government, and, I mean, they do claim, now I say they, the government claims to act in our name, and if we do not do what we can to oppose that, we bear a degree of responsibility for what it does. And so back in 1980, there was a debate, actually, which is getting a little ahead of ourselves, but there was a debate. Carter originally proposed to require both men and women to register for the draft. Congress spent some months debating that in the face of a lot of protest. There were demonstrations by tens of thousands of people, which seemingly had no effect at all on Congress, and they went ahead and voted to require men but not women to register for the draft, starting in 1980. And since then, men have been required to register when they turn 18 and to tell the Selective Service every time they move until they turn 26. But what happened was that there was, although the protest, the marching in the streets, the complaint had really no effect, direct action had a big effect. This was one of the great success stories of nonviolent direct action during what were otherwise pretty dark times of the Reagan era. The number of people who simply ignored the call to register for the draft was many times larger than even the most optimistic of us in the anti-draft movement had expected. The government, after floundering around for a couple of years, eventually decided, for want of anything else they could think of to do about this massive resistance, to hold some show trials of a few of the people they thought were the most vocal non-registrants in order to intimidate everybody else into registering. And I was one of 20 people, only 20 people across the country, who were picked out to be prosecuted. And although, you know, most of us were convicted, some of us did go to prison, But the show trial served only to call attention to the resistance and call attention to the fact that only the people who spoke up publicly could possibly be prosecuted, because the government had to prove that we knew we were supposed to register, which they could only do by using our own public statements, which were, you know, introduced in court against us. So registration went down from there and has never recovered. And as former Selective Service and Justice Department officials have recently confirmed, the government decided in 1987 that enforcement was hopeless, and they suspended any effort to try to enforce the law and make people register. So for the last 30 years, it's been possible for people to ignore registration completely with no risk that they're actually going to face any criminal sanctions.
So what percentage of young men 18 to 26 do register with Selective Service? Do you know?
We don't really know. There has not been an audit of Selective Service and its database by the GAO since 1982. A lot of people do register at some point because they want to get student loans or some participate in some other federal program that requires that. But although, as I mentioned, you're supposed to, it's probably a surprise to you even, David, I would guess, to hear that people are supposed to report to Selective Service every time they move until they turn 26. Essentially, nobody does.
Yeah.
And that one audit in 1982, just 2 years after registration started, the GAO found that 20% to 40% of the addresses were already then out of date. Today, it's pretty clear that the overwhelming majority of addresses on file with Selective Service are obsolete because nobody tells Selective Service when they move, and that if there were to be a draft based on this list, it would be a fiasco because most of the induction notices would end up in the dead letter office.
Yeah. Shockingly, I'm over 26 at this point, but I certainly did not report where I lived to the Selective Service when I was under 26. With even Hillary Clinton now pretending to be in favor of free college, if that becomes a reality in this country, as in other countries, they'll have to come up with some other means of pressuring young men to register for Selective Service than student aid. But what has put this topic back on the agenda in Congress and otherwise in recent months?
Well, as I mentioned, there was a debate back in 1980 about whether to include women. There were lawsuits challenging whether it was constitutional or whether it was discriminatory to require men but not women to register for the draft, one of which went to the Supreme Court in 1981. Which upheld requiring only men to register because at that time the military only wanted men in combat. And since a draft would be needed for combat, the Supreme Court found that this choice to register only men was rationally related to this government purpose. And as the courts usually do, unfortunately, they deferred to the military judgment about the military and put that ahead of anything else. However, now that combat and all roles within the military are being opened up to women, equally with men, that rationale for the constitutionality of requiring men and not women to register clearly is no longer viable. There are already lawsuits, again, renewed lawsuits challenging this, which are likely to be successful. And so seeing the writing on the wall, Congress is being forced to choose in one direction, to move in one direction or the other. Either, you know, they have to treat men and women equally. So the question is, do we get rid of the current registration requirement and draft registration, which has failed anyway and would be useless in the event of a draft, or do we double down on this, you know, decades-long failure by trying to get women as well as men to register, which would be likely to be at least as much of a fiasco because at least as many women would resist as men have resisted. There's going to be at least as much support for women who are saying they don't want to agree to fight and kill on demand. There's a long history of feminist anti-war and pacifist activism. Women have played a leading role over the years in opposition to conscription, even when it was only men who were being drafted. But this is the choice that Congress is faced. They haven't had a face-saving way out. Draft registration has failed, but there was no way to end it without admitting that it was failed and dealing with the implications of that for war-making policy. But now Congress can't avoid it. And so they're debating that choice of which way to go.
They can't end it because they don't need it, because they fight their immoral, criminal, murderous wars without it, and have done so just fine for decades and are starting to use robots. I mean, they can't come up with a reason to end it.
Well, there are some who are saying, well, we should, some liberals who are saying, well, we should end draft registration because we don't need it. But there really are still people in Congress who are saying, we want this insurance policy in our back pocket so that just in case we get into a war that's requiring, millions of frontline troops and producing such massive casualties that not the active duty forces, not the reserves, not the National Guard, not the mercenaries and contractors who we're hiring to fight our wars for us, that we want to be prepared to be able to fight wars that are going to take even more cannon fodder than that, and so we want to be able to rely on having the draft available. This is the sickness of the argument that's being made when you look below the surface for continuing draft registration.
Yeah, so
I think this is a big piece of the significance. I think a lot of people have looked at this and thought, well, there's no real threat of the draft, so why should we care? But the point of why folks like me resisted draft registration and why so many women and men supported us in that. I didn't go to prison to stay out of the draft. I could have just blown it off and stayed home and not spoken out and been completely safe, as millions of other people did. I resisted actively because I wanted to use the defeat of the draft as a tool to constrain the war-making power of the government. So we had this half victory. We stopped the draft, but we never really followed through to get the public and Congress and the Pentagon to admit that the draft was not a real option and that they needed to adjust their war-making plans accordingly. That's the follow-through that we need to carry out now as Congress resumes debate on this issue.
We're speaking with Edward Hasbrook, whose website is resistors.info. What do you say to the inevitable peace activists who actually want a draft? It's incredibly frustrating and, to my mind, grotesque and immoral, but very predictable. Everywhere I go and speak against the draft, I get questions from peace activists who want to end war by having a draft. How do you answer that concern?
Well, I think the best answer was the one that Dan Ellsberg gave in your conversation with him in San Francisco recently when you were asked about that. And Dan said, well, yes, the draft did provoke a larger anti-war movement and brought people into the streets, but the draft also enabled the larger war. And what Dan Ellsberg said, and I think rightly, was that if we actually had the draft going on and the military had more troops available, at the call-up without having to try to recruit them, we'd see much larger numbers of ground troops on the ground in Syria, in Yemen, in who knows how many other more countries. So I think he was right on with that and saying that part of the lesson of Vietnam was the way that the draft enabled a larger war with less public debate.
Did Dan speak to that topic at the end when I'd gone off to sign books? Because
yes, he did. Exactly.
Okay. Because during the conversation, I had said the same thing myself, and Dan hadn't spoken to it. Well, I agree, of course. The draft gives you bigger wars and more dead, and we haven't had a war since Vietnam that killed anywhere close to 4 million people, maybe 6 million people, including Laos and Cambodia, directly, immediately. The wars haven't been as bad, and you can imagine. I mean, wouldn't it have to be an even worse war by a huge measure than Vietnam for them to have a draft now, given the resistance to it, given the mercenaries and the drones and so forth? Wouldn't it have to be a war, approaching World War II or worse for them to have a draft now?
There's really it's difficult to imagine what real scenario for a war that would actually call for those numbers. And so there's another aspect to the draft, and we also hear this question about, well, you know, they're not really going to have a draft, it's just registration. Part of the reason why some people on the other side want draft registration, even if they don't actually want a draft now, is that it serves as a tool to collect information that goes to military recruiters. It serves to channel people into the military as volunteers. It constrains people with student debt that limits their options after they get out of college, if they go to college. And more broadly, it accustoms everybody to the idea that we owe it to the government to serve, and that somehow fighting for whoever the government wants us to fight is service to the national interest, that the government defines for us what is the national interest, which, of course, is the opposite of democracy.
There was,
and I have to point out here the fallacy for those who say, well, you know, aren't you willing to, you know, to fight for American interests? Just how poor historically the judgment calls of this government have been. As I said, back in 1980 when draft registration was brought back, it was to be prepared to intervene in Afghanistan on the side of the Mujahideen. I went to prison for refusing to agree to fight on the side of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And I think that says about as much as you need to hear about the degree to which we should trust the government's ability to decide for us which wars we should be fighting or on which side, even if you believe in war, which as a pacifist I don't.
Yeah, but I think your position and mine is perhaps more popular than we always realize. There was a poll done by Gallup at the end of 2014 in many countries around the world, and one of the questions they always asked was, would you be willing to go and fight in a war for your country? And I was very pleased to see lots of countries down around 10-15% of people who would ever be willing to fight in a war for their country. In the United States, it was quite a bit higher at 44%. Here we have several wars ongoing and always wars ongoing. Nothing's stopping these people. You don't actually have 44% who actually want to go and fight in a U.S. war because they could just go register and do so tomorrow. But they want to think of themselves that way. But still, 44% is not a majority. It's not as if everybody in the U.S. public wants to or would be willing to go and fight in a war, and yet you have a law requiring that every male and potentially every female of a certain age register to do so with no options for other service or actual service or conscientious objection. So, isn't this a very anti-democratic imposition and violation of our rights?
Well, of course it is. And in terms of the other options, you know, as you pointed out, you know, there's actually a pretty large number of people who would fight if they thought that there was something that justified it. I mean, there were a lot of volunteers after 9/11. There were volunteers in World War II and so forth. But what people want to do is to make that choice for themselves. And that's precisely the choice that they're not allowed to do now. And even if there were a draft, people are allowed to do alternative service as a conscientious objector only if they oppose all wars. Someone who wants to reserve to themselves the choice of which wars to fight does not qualify under the government's definition of a conscientious objector. And so for the majority of people who are not pacifists but do oppose some wars, the only options to avoid being drafted are either the illegal options that they're choosing now, opting out by simply not complying with the law, or political agitation to get this law changed, which is, I think, where we really need to go over the next year or so, or we're going to face a long, painful process of women having to organize, mobilize, resist, probably some of them go to prison before the government gives up on trying to enforce draft registration on women the same way it had to do for men.
Is that movement growing? Are people getting active? Are women resisting now in a new way?
I think women are opposing this, whether relatively few people, knowing that it's those who speak out publicly who are going to be singled out, it's mostly fairly quiet. But, I mean, there are encouraging signs to the extent that women are aware of this, that they're outraged. I think Congress is really lagging behind popular sentiment. There's been an effort to portray this as an issue of women's equality in the military, rather than to look at it as coercion into the military. And it divides even some women. I mean, there are liberal women, such as Hillary Clinton, and believers in equality for women. I was at a town hall with Congressman Jackie Speier, who's on the Armed Services Committee, who's been one of the advocates of this, this weekend, and she was asked about it and launched into a whole rap about how important it was for women in the military to have equal rights. I'm sorry that being drafted is not a right, it's not a privilege, it's a burden imposed on you when people come to you under the threat of putting you in prison and make you take up a gun and shoot it at whoever they tell you to shoot at. That's not a benefit. This is not about women's equality, but there's an effort to, as I say, to efface that whole history of feminist analysis that has led women to oppose the draft even when only men are being drafted. I mean, when men fight, women die too. And war and conscription and militarization of society have historically been part of what's criticized as part of the patriarchy, and rightly so. So radical feminists have a long tradition of being leaders in anti-war activism that's just being written out of the present debate.
But in recent months, correct me if I'm wrong, bills have been blocked, voted down in Congress that on the one hand would have expanded the Selective Service to include women and on the other hand would have ended it for men. Both of those have been blocked, and the one that would have expanded it for women had the support of every good liberal Democrat as defending women's rights to be forced into the military. And you and I and other opponents of that expansion found ourselves aligned with right-wing Republicans whose, you know, respect for women's rights is negligible to non-existent.
That's pretty much correct. That the only opposition to registering women for the draft that the press and Congress have been willing to acknowledge is what's coming from the socially conservative, sexist, often militarist, sexist right wing. We need to make the progressive anti-war critique of the draft. We need to force that into the debate. Congress doesn't want to start talking about their power being constrained by popular direct action. They're not going to do that for us. We need to stand up and talk about it. We need to make clear that we will fully support young women who refuse to register. And a further evil in the way the proposal is currently couched is that the bill that's moving forward now, it's currently in conference between the House and the Senate, but it would add women to draft registration starting with women born in 2000, starting 2 years from now in 2018. So the women who are most threatened are 16-year-olds, and I think, you know, it's a pretty devious measure to have a deferred start date so that the people whose rights you're threatening are not people who can already vote, but are, you know, high school student women who are 16-year-olds. Who are probably going to have relatively limited access and relatively limited empowerment to be able to take, you know, a kind of high-risk public stance. So I think what we'll likely see is a lot of, you know, women just quietly staying home. But it's up to us as a movement to make clear that we will support that resistance, to be out there saying that the emperor has no clothes. It's just not going to be possible to round up every 18-year-old woman and force her to agree to be drafted. It's not realistic. But that's not part of the terms of debate yet. We have to make it so.
Yeah, well, I would like the inevitable failure and lack of being realistic to be part of the debate, but also the evil and the madness of the war and the desirability of having more women fighting in wars, whether forced to or so-called volunteering. I mean, nobody is proposing that we have more female police officers out there killing black people in the United States for equality and feminism, right? But it's because the wars are somehow acceptable as something that's not evil, that we want to have more females and more gay soldiers and more transgender soldiers and, you know, a progressive military. I think that has to be part of the debate, does it not?
That, you know, for me, and I presume for you too, David, there's no such thing as a progressive military. And the last thing Congress wants is a debate about, you know, whether they're on the right side or the wrong side or should be fighting these wars at all. This is why this is not just, you know, we feel like we're on the defensive, but this is an opportunity to force open a kind of debate that hasn't been going on about the legitimacy and the nature of the wars that are being fought. We can use this in a jujitsu kind of way to break open a debate that hasn't been happening about war and our relationship to it as individual Americans.
We have just a few minutes left. Do you know how common it is around the world to force young people to sign up for a potential draft? I mean, does every country do this or do most countries not do this any longer?
I mean, there's been a global trend toward a so-called volunteer army. Now, volunteer armies, it should be clear, have lots of problems. Often, as in the U.S., there is a de facto poverty draft that pushes people into the military. But increasingly, among countries that want to call themselves democratic, the trend has been against compulsory service, and there's been growing recognition that conscription violates even basic international human rights law. It's one more place where the U.S. is increasingly out of step with the rest of the world on human rights in all its manifestations.
Is there any possibility in the years ahead to get a treaty in place that ends conscription for all of its national parties or globally and universally?
We're not there yet. I mean, I think what's, you know, the starting point is some degree of allowance for a civilian alternative, but that still doesn't solve the problem, and that still results in people being coerced into, you know, slave labor for the state as the state defines what their lives should be doing. We may end up next year seeing that kind of debate, which raises yet another round of questions. It may be that the way that people in Congress try to salvage some kind of draft for men and women in a way that they hope won't provoke anti-war resistance is to say, well, we're going to expand it even more and have a universal national service plan where everybody has to work in some state-assigned labor for a period of time, and they can choose to do it in the military or in a civilian job. That would further divide movements against it. There are some liberals who would support that kind of compulsory service. There are many libertarians who would oppose conscription, whether for civilian or military purposes.
Yeah, I guess I would oppose it if military were included, but it might be superior to military alone. We've got about 20 seconds left. What's your position?
I don't think you can separate those out, really, and I don't think that we owe our lives to the government. It's up to us in a democratic society to make our own choices and for government to follow.
Very well said, and all of it very well said, and we will have links to your website and articles at talknationradio.org. Edward Hasbrook can be found at resistors.info. Ed, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
My pleasure, and thank you for all you do, David.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Countersleep.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, few ideas are as hardwired into corporate media as the notion that so-called free trade agreements of the sort we have are, despite concerns, best for everyone, and anyway, inevitable. Given that the deals are not primarily about trade and that what freedom they entail applies to corporations and not people, you could say media's use of the term free trade implies a bias against clarity, if nothing else. This week, Counterspin will revisit three clarifying interviews we've done on this issue. We'll hear from Lori Wallach of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, whose 2008 discussion of NAFTA is really Trade Pacts 101. Peter Maybarduk from Public Citizens Global Access to Medicines program talked with Steve Rendell early in 2015 about the impact of another deal, the TPP, on healthcare. And later in the year, Karen Hansen-Kuhn of the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy talked about the effects of the TPP on food and farming. Three critical discussions about corporate media and corporate-friendly globalization on today's Counterspin. The Wall Street Journal had it recently that leading Democratic presidential contenders Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton have ratcheted up their anti-trade, anti-corporate rhetoric. The Washington Post took Obama to task in an editorial for exaggerating job losses due to trade pacts, sniffing that such ideas were, quote, not worthy of a candidate whose past speeches and writings demonstrate that he understands the benefits of free trade, close quote. But in reporting on the candidates and trade issues, the remarkable thing is not so much Obama or Clinton's criticism of corporate-driven trade policy as corporate media's uncritical, at times near hysterical, defense of it. What misinformation still sets the stage for this country's global trade debate, and how could journalists redirect the conversation? Joining us now to talk about this is Lori Wallach, director of Global Trade Watch at Public Citizen. Welcome to Counterspin, Lori Wallach.
Thank you very much.
Well, first of all, that's kind of a simple question. Isn't it just a little late in the game for outlets like the Wall Street Journal to refer to arguments that are critical of existing trade pacts like NAFTA as being anti-trade arguments? It seems an indication of just kind of the crudity of the whole conversation.
The data is in. We've had one model of trade and globalization implemented under agreements such as the World Trade Organization, or NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. We've had 15 years to see how that would work, and the data's come in showing the United States has lost net 3 million of its manufacturing jobs in that 15-year period. And for the first time in our country's modern history, less than 10% of the population is employed in manufacturing. Why does that matter for all of us? Because the data also show that when you change out higher-paid manufacturing jobs with lower-paid service sector jobs, wages economy-wide are pushed down. So the government data show, in real terms, U.S. median wages are at about 1972 levels, even though worker productivity has doubled. Now think tanks that supported NAFTA and WTO are writing papers admitting that a significant contribution to that wage suppression is what they call labor arbitrage. Having U.S. workers directly competing with workers who make a dollar a day, why? Not through an act of God, but because agreements like NAFTA and WTO included foreign investor rules that directly incentivized offshoring, relocation of production from the U.S. to low-wage countries, by removing most of the risks normally associated with businesses going to a developing country.
Mm-hmm.
NAFTA, WTO, they provide guaranteed minimum standards of treatment. They forbid developing countries from applying the kind of policies they used to foreign investors. Things like you have to use a certain percentage of domestic content, or you have to transfer technology to us. And they require that foreign companies operating in a place like China now get all the subsidies that domestic companies get. So all those huge energy subsidies. Fully 60% of the exports of China come from multinational corporations that have moved there for production. Those incentives in those agreements have had these outcomes, and the American public has had it. And in fact, for these candidates simply to implement their domestic policy goals, creating jobs, tackling income inequality, dealing with health care crisis and the climate change crisis, will require changes to these agreements.
Well, in light of that data and that reality, I wonder what you make of the kind of media coverage that takes the tone that people are sort of, that it's a belief that NAFTA has affected jobs. The Washington Post said that Hillary Clinton was distancing herself from NAFTA, quote, which is unpopular among workers in manufacturing who believe the deal has contributed to the movement of jobs overseas, close quote. What do you make of that kind of psychologizing of what, as you've just indicated, is just a hard reality?
Well, as a recovering trade attorney who's up to her ears in all the government data that proves that these agreements have had these effects, it's infuriating, actually. The data is very clear, and the only good news is a lot of politicians who are having to come face-to-face with Americans who've lived the experience are actually starting to, by political necessity, take steps to change the current policies regardless of what the elite media are saying to try and convince them otherwise. But there's still a lot of work to do. So, for instance, Senators Obama and Clinton, they have been escalating their rhetoric against NAFTA since the Iowa primary. And in a way, it's excellent that they have felt the need to respond to the public's anxiety that they're facing all across the country. The problem is, to date, they really haven't put forward proposals about what they're going to do. So they're sort of feeling our pain, but they've only talked about adding labor and environmental standards to NAFTA, mainly in public. And though important, and in part of building in the long term a social contract for workers in those countries, that could take 100 years like it did in our country. The things that have to be done, which reflect not just NAFTA, but the World Trade Organization, China trade, those things such as removing the investment rules in these so-called trade agreements that directly promote offshoring, removing the ban on local preferences and Buy America rules in all of these trade agreements, NAFTA, WTO, that would totally gut the candidates' proposals for green jobs or for creating good jobs by rebuilding the U.S. infrastructure. That is what needs to be addressed, and the candidates, just to succeed at what they claim are their own priorities, are going to have to deal with this stuff.
Well, is it putting those questions to them specifically? Is it that? And what else do you think reporters might do differently as we go forward, given that this it looks like this is going to stay an issue in the election, to improve or uplift, if you will, the quality of the coverage around trade?
Well, certainly asking some of those specific questions, and we put out an advisory about a week ago that listed questions the candidates probably don't want to hear, but will save them from not being able to, in the future, implement their policy goals. And those questions, which get to the actual changing the terms of globalization by changing the rules questions, the candidates need to address, but also there's now enormous amounts of data. You can go to our website, tradewatch.org, the Economic Policy Institute, the Center for Economic Policy and Research, that take the government data, have footnotes until you could choke, proving that actually these outcomes have occurred, and then showing how they are specifically connected to the agreements. And this information might help remedy, cure the psychologizing that you see in a lot of the mainstream media that makes it seem like NAFTA is some boogeyman that American workers are imagining is under their bed, as compared to these are specific choices, interests, that wanted to pursue certain strategies for their maximizing of profits got their protections to help them offshore, put in specific instruments called NAFTA, WTO, that deliver a specific version of globalization. It got test run for over a decade. The results are in. It ain't working. And the good news, there are some very specific things you could do were you to be president to change those agreements to get different outcomes.
I'd like to thank you very much. We've been speaking with Lori Wallach, director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Find them on the web at tradewatch.org. Thanks for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you.
On November 13th, WikiLeaks released a leaked chapter of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. The TPP is a secretly negotiated so-called free trade agreement. The new information is the draft of the TPP's chapter dealing with intellectual property. According to WikiLeaks spokesperson Julian Assange, quote, if instituted, the TPP's intellectual property regime would trample over individual rights and free expression, as well as ride roughshod over the intellectual and creative commons. If you read, write, publish, think, listen, dance, sing, or invent, if you farm or consume food, if you're ill now or might one day be ill, the TPP has you in its crosshairs, close quote. The group Public Citizen has been on the TPP story from the beginning. We are joined by Peter Maybarduke, director of Public Citizen's Global Access to Medicines Program. Welcome to Counterspin, Peter Maybarduke.
It's good to be here.
Well, speaking generally about the draft chapter, do you think Julian Assange is right? And could you describe some of the ways these policies, if implemented, would affect people where they live?
I do think he's right. What's really at stake here is it's two very different visions of the world, one in which knowledge and information is closed off, controlled by companies via exclusive rights systems, monopolized, and we rely on them to essentially steward the public interest. The other vision is much more open vision, in which we collaborate and build on each other's knowledge and promote access to knowledge and knowledge goods. And this is tremendously important because it affects many aspects of our daily lives. It affects our freedom online. There are proposals in the agreement that would take creative and cultural works out of the public domain for a longer period of time, that would force internet service providers to act as copyright enforcers on online, take down a lot of content that is in fact free speech, that is in fact satire or parody of copyrighted materials. There are issues of plant and animal patents. The United States government is trying to force other countries to broadly patent and promote the exclusive ownership of plant varieties and animals and these different sort of gene patent issues. You know, the issue I work on of healthcare, access to medicines, access to affordable healthcare is an issue that could really be affected by this agreement.
Well, I'd like to get to that now. It's hard to imagine anything more important than healthcare. You're the director of Public Citizen's Global Access to Medicines Program. How would the TPP, if this draft were put in place, affect healthcare specifically?
You were correct to call it a so-called trade agreement. What we really have here is a secret rulemaking against public health. Worldwide access to medicines depends in no small part on countries being able to obtain generics, either locally manufactured or imported from India. This keeps costs down for cancer, HIV/AIDS. And HIV/AIDS, for example, globally, we've been able to save about 10 million lives worldwide since 2000 due to generic competition. It would have been completely impossible if the brand name companies had been allowed to continue to dominate and monopolize that field. And that's precisely what's at stake in the TPP. This is the U.S. government, due to the lobbying and political influence of Big Pharma, advancing a number of proposals to expand patent monopolies and take medicines out of the public domain, make the periods for which medicines on which we all depend are monopolized longer. And it's principally about taking the current state of the U.S. rules, which are dominated by this lobby, and imposing them on developing countries, where it's completely the difference between life and death for a great many people. But it's also the case that some of these rules, and especially one rule that we're expecting the United States to advance very soon in this negotiation, would actually bind U.S. consumers, would actually bind Americans to bad systems that we have now, which we are trying to undo. So, for example, a very unfortunate rule was advanced in Obamacare, which monopolizes new cancer drugs for 12 years. These treatments cost $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, $100,000 a year. We all know people who have suffered and struggled and had real troubles with their household budgets trying to find a way to pay for cancer medications. Now, the White House, for the past couple of years, has presented a budget that seeks to reduce that monopoly period so that we can have affordable biosimilars, what they're called. So this is billions of dollars per year at stake, and you know, Americans' budgets and Americans' ability to deal with cancer and heart disease and other illnesses. So publicly, the administration has said it's trying to change this rule. It's trying to peel back the monopolies. But in this trade negotiation, the United States is going to advance a proposal which would actually lock us in to the 12-year period. Once we've signed the TPP with a 12-year period in it, we'd be bound by that. We wouldn't be able to undo. We'd lose our congressional ability to overturn the bad rule. So secretly, behind closed doors, the Obama administration is doing very different things with regard to health care than their stated public commitments. Rather than promoting global health and rather than trying to reduce costs at home, we're smashing global health. We're very aggressively trying to bully countries into accepting measures that would lead to preventable suffering and death. And we're giving away the store to Big Pharma here in the United States, too.
The Washington Post reported on the draft chapter on November 13th, focusing on how opposition to TPP has brought together unlikely allies, including the Tea Party on one hand and Public Citizen and a high-toned gaggle of PhD economists on the other. So the word seems to be getting out, right? I mean, there has been some coverage.
I think this is a very good week for us, and we need to capitalize on it. These agreements are negotiated behind closed doors. There's incredibly little public access. You can't sit on the negotiation. You can't see the text. Members of Congress can't see the text. And because there are so many aggressive pro-corporate proposals in it and so many objectionable ideas, these agreements depend on that secrecy in order to pass. And the U.S. Trade Representative is rather open about that fact, that they need the secrecy in order to successfully negotiate and be able to get these ideas through. And so when we have moments like this where there's public attention, it's very important to advance that. Prior agreements have failed once they come into the spotlight.
We've been speaking with Peter May Barduk, Director of Public Citizen's Global Access to Medicines Program. You can see Public Citizen's work on the TPP and everything else at citizen.org. Thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin, Peter May Barduk.
Thank you.
NBC News offered a little primer on the Trans-Pacific Partnership on its website, in which the TPP was described as an ambitious trade accord between the United States and 11 South American and Pacific Rim nations, whose goal is a freer flow of everything. Supporters, NBC News said, seek to remove barriers to trade and boost the American economy, while opponents are vocal in their displeasure because they say the proposed deal was cobbled together in secret and sticks it to American workers. Well, this piece is pretty typical in the suggestion that, for one, pacts like TPP are first and foremost about barriers to trade, and then that the debate is essentially between practical people who believe in growth and special interests known mainly for yapping. The funny thing is, for all that supposedly vocal displeasure, and despite the fact that the pact is widely acknowledged as controversial, you don't hear much of any depth in media about TPP critics' specific concerns or their alternatives. Nor, it seems, of those critics themselves. April 18th was Global Trade Day. Tens of thousands of people demonstrated in cities across Europe and here in the U.S. against the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, the TTIP, being negotiated between the U.S. and the European Union.
with hardly a peep from the U.S. press about those demonstrations. Well, joining us now to talk about some of the anticipated impacts of trade pacts now currently being negotiated is Karen Hansen-Kuhn, Director of International Strategies at the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. Welcome back to Counterspin, Karen Hansen-Kuhn.
Thank you.
Well, media virtually always describe TPP as controversial. There's debate over it about fast track and a number of other issues. But beyond that sort of label, we usually just get some tossed off phrases. The pact will cost jobs or it will create jobs. I wonder, can you describe with some illustration what impact you see TPP, and feel free to address the TTIP as well, the impact that you see such pacts having, particularly on something that's come to matter a lot to many people as one way that they can kind of connect their politics with their immediate lives, and that's food economies.
Sure. Well, I guess I would separate that into two related pieces. One is farming and one is food. So on farming, I've been at this for a while, and if we look at all of the promises that have been made since the NAFTA debate, and it is this thing, just what NBC was saying, that it's about making things flow more easily. Well, making things flow more easily, it means very specifically that foreign investors in different countries get a lot more protections. So they're able to move production to wherever things are cheapest, and along the way, farmers lose bargaining power. So what we've seen in the United States since NAFTA is a dramatic increase in corporate concentration in agriculture, decrease in family farms, and farmers struggling with low prices. And so they're told the solution is to grow more and to export. That argument is running really sour with people right now. We just had a sign-on letter last week where 113 farm organizations said no to this model. So that's on the farm side. It hasn't been good for farmers here or in developing countries. On the food side, we have people taking different initiatives at the local level to change things, improving food safety laws, implementing ambitious farm-to-school programs. All of those things, from what we know about TPP and TTIP, could be under attack because, again, the whole idea of these agreements is to make trade flow. So rules on food safety, for example, would have to be subject to the test that they distort trade as little as possible. Rather than saying first, they have to protect public health with trade as an afterthought. So that's going to shape the kinds of food safety rules we get. Farm-to-school programs is something we're also very concerned about. And here, we have some leaked texts from the European Union where they're talking very specifically about wanting to open up public procurement programs in the U.S. So that could mean buy local programs, both for farmers and other industries. But again, it would impact rural economies. It would impact what say we have decision-making on what's in our food system.
So you're saying something like the New York City system, if the municipality decides that they want to encourage regional farming, and they want to do that by saying that New York City public schools, for example, will rely to some measure on locally produced farm goods, that sort of buying local program would be in the sights of something like this?
It seems very possible. Again, you know that we're dealing with secret agreements, but from what we can piece together, that's certainly something that could be subject to attack. The other thing we worry about are initiatives like some municipalities or states are considering bans on certain toxic chemicals or pesticides, like neonicotinoids, which are associated with bee colony collapse. That kind of thing, too, could get caught up in these new restrictions put on food safety and toxics regulations. Again, they'd have to be, say, well, of the different choices, which one distorts trade the least? Well, that really shouldn't be our starting point.
Well, and we have some record here in the EU as well. There is some history, as I understand it, with the United States wanting to sell beef produced with hormones in the EU where they have policies against that. What does that look like?
Well, yeah, when I talk to folks in the EU, what I hear pretty consistently are concerns about opening up to imports of GMOs, which are for the most part prohibited, are restrictions on GMOs, restrictions on beef produced with hormone, restrictions on poultry, chicken rinsed in chlorine, all practices that they don't want in Europe, that are the victories of local movements. And there are tens of thousands of people out on the streets at different points about those issues.
It's always kind of irritating to me to hear that the secrecy that surrounds these pacts as a sign of something wrong, when I think the secrecy is itself something wrong. It's not an indicator, it's a problem and on the face of it. Who should be involved in this process that is not involved?
Well, certainly they could open up the whole process and say what exactly they're negotiating as a starting point. In the past, for the Free Trade Area of the Americas, they published negotiating texts online. There's still three versions online where you can see where there were points of disagreement. So then you could have really citizens groups, affected sectors, dairy industry or dairy workers, say, looking at how they might be affected by a change in import rules. We don't have that this time. What we have are some very general statements about what they might do, and then text that gets leaked through WikiLeaks or maybe coming from the European Union. So it's a crazy process, and I think what you see is more and more groups across the country and in various countries finding ways to get that information. But it really doesn't have to be that way. There's no reason they couldn't open up the process, that they couldn't consult on these food and farm issues with people who would need to hear about it. And in any case, honor a notion they have in Europe, one of the founding ideas of the European Union, of subsidiarity, that decisions get made at the lowest level practical. So if a community is deciding they're going to ban a toxic pesticide, allow room for that. Base our decision-making on things like pesticides and food safety on the precautionary principle. When there's uncertainty, err on the side of caution. These are the kinds of things that should be the principles we're looking at. And as I said, there are tens of thousands of people already getting engaged. I think we don't see it as much in the U.S. or as visibly, say, as in Europe. On the other hand, there were this day of action you mentioned. There were 65 actions across the U.S. And there are hundreds of groups across the country focusing right now on Fast Track, which is very much about this issue of secrecy.
We've been speaking with Karen Hansen-Kuhn. She's Director of International Strategies at the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. You can find them online at iatp.org. Karen Hansen-Kuhn, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
All right. Thank you.
And that's it for this week on Counterspin. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
It's a quick 1-2 punch this week. Later, we'll hear from the one and only Albert Bates on the wonder of biochar and how it might save the world's climate. But first, some scientists and authorities, like the International Energy Agency, warn humanity is headed for a world 3.5 degrees C hotter in as little, perhaps, as 25 years. Perhaps you think we'll just turn up the air conditioner, but much of the world's work is done outside. Can humans cope with those kind of temperatures? Here to help us is Dr. Elizabeth Hanna. She's a nurse with a doctorate and national convener of the Climate Change Adaptation Research Network for Human Health at Australian National University. We've reached Dr. Hanna in Warsaw at the COP19 Climate Talks. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
And hello to your listeners.
I appreciate your taking the time to talk with us amid what must be very intense climate talks in Warsaw. What was it like being there?
I can tell you, it's really hectic. I think the numbers are something like 8,000. And of course, the meetings go all through the night. It's a wonderful experience. And there's a lot of tensions because obviously people are wanting a lot more than what some of the partners are willing to commit to.
Liz, let's get to your specialty, the capacity of the human body to cope with climate change. What are the challenges that we will face?
If we continue up to, that 3.5 and some say 4 and indeed 6 degrees, the essential thing is this is ultimately, it's not compatible with human existence. That's the raw and the ugly truth of it. And that's why we really do need to do something about it. And of course, the pathway to that is it's not all going to be hunky-dory and really nice until one day it's not pleasant. It'll be this gradual increasing change, such as we're already noticing. And if you notice the heat waves that are happening all over the world, the floods, the droughts, the typhoons such as Haiyan, this is happening when it's not even 1 degrees warmer. I shudder to think what 2 degrees, the guardrail that we're all trying to stay below, even that is going to cause so much more human misery. So, I mean, the major health impacts, it depends really on where you are. The countries that are vulnerable to these typhoons, they're obviously going to have more of those, such as the Philippines. It's very difficult for the climate scientists to attribute any specific particular event to, this one was climate change. But that's in many respects the wrong question. The trend is on the basis of probability, the fact that we're getting so many more and they're so more intense, that's the real question, and the answer to that is a definite yes. And so the people that are suffering the typhoons, Australia's had, intense droughts, intense heat waves and intense floods, and we're not alone. Europe lost, some reports, including the World Health Organization, suggest that 70,000 people died in the heat waves in Europe. And that's temperatures that are nothing like what Australia hits, but the whole thing is relative. Russia, the Moscow heat wave, A, caused lots of fires, B, caused a lot of crop failures. And one of the sort of less direct impacts are when you have major heat waves and droughts and indeed floods. If you wipe out the crops from one of the major food exporting countries, such as what Russia did at that time, and you can sort of understand, if they lose a good deal of their stable crops, they stopped exporting. When a major food exporter stops exporting, the food prices globally escalate, and that carries over to the other basic foodstuffs. And if you think about the people who are largely dependent, particularly the sub-Saharan African people, if they're already spending 80% of their weekly income on food, their capacity to absorb doubling or an extra 50% of the food prices is not something that they can't really do. So there are the complex ramifications in terms of food shortages and food insecurity, water problems. Obviously, people are going to suffer if they're caught in the floods, the risk of cholera and the waterborne diseases. General heat causes a lot of extra foodborne diseases. And, of course, when you change the climate and you get, the malaria, which once upon a time was restricted to a certain area because it doesn't like getting below 15 degrees, when you find with warming in many countries, the range of the mosquito is extending into what we call virgin populations. And so the people who are not equipped to cope physiologically and indeed in their cultural practices, and indeed the medicos who, you know, they're not used to looking for, you know, malaria. Dengue is another one that's extending. And of course, my own work is heat. That's a real killer for places like Australia. But of course, as we've seen, I mean, cooler places like Russia and Europe have had massive death rates because of heat.
Well, let's talk about the human body. What are the upper tolerances that we can handle?
It's interesting. When you think about it, we need to keep our core temperature within a really very narrow range between about 36 and 37. And when the outside air temperature is higher than that, then it's very difficult for us to lose heat. And we generate heat just through our metabolism. But it's interesting that sort of 80% of the energy produced by working muscles is heat. So that has to be dissipated. And when you have temperatures outside the human body, the ambient temperature, that's getting close to that, then it's really difficult to shed that extra heat. And so if we can't shed it, we store it. And as you know, when your temperature gets to about 38, you start feeling pretty ordinary. 38.5, you're certainly reaching for the Panadol. And in hospitals where I've started my working career, we'd be certainly giving not only aspirins but antibiotics. You're really quite ill when your core temperature is about 39. And, of course, people die when their core temperature reaches 40, 41. We really can't tolerate that. And what's really significant is that it depends on what your normal range is, your normal natural environment, but there is an upper limit. And if you think about when people like to put the air conditioning on or the heating, they tend to set it at around about 22 degrees, which is 15 degrees cooler than our body temperature. And, of course, this basically means that when the outside temperature is much hotter than our body temperature, then this is when it becomes problematic.
Liz Hanna, in the business press, major corporations and economists worry a lot about worker productivity. They tell us productive workforce, that's the key, yet they don't seem to worry about global warming at the same time. Or are they missing something?
Absolutely. And this is a focus of a good deal of the work that I'm doing at the moment. That's actually looking to see what is the human thermal tolerance. I mean, obviously I'm Australian and my work is focused on Australia at the moment, but it's part of a global project. But at the moment, what we find is that the places in the southern part of the continent, they actually think are hot days around about, you know, 25, 27 degrees. They can keep working, but they feel it hot. At the top end of Australia, where it's in the tropical region, we've got Darwin that's sort of 32, 33 degrees. It used to be 32, 33 every day. Well, now it's sort of 35 every day. But the humidity is extreme. And every time when we go and visit those places, the plane opens and we just get knocked by this wall of sort of oppressive heat and humidity, and we find it very difficult to move. A lot of people move up to Darwin and you know, the other tropical areas around Australia, as they would do to the hot areas and other places. Those that can't cope with it pack up and go home back to a cooler place. And we find a lot of, you know, if people are sent to work, if their families can't cope, they move back. What's really becoming alarming is that a lot of these areas are going to become even more intensively hot, and that's going to probably make even a smaller proportion of the population be able to cope. And, of course, all these places involve, you know, people that work in construction, people that climb up your telephone poles to fix those when we're in the power blackout, the people that change your car tyres, the district nurses who go out and visit people. And, of course, in the heat waves in Australia, you could imagine the district nurses are really not very inclined to call in sick saying, oh, no, look, it's too hot, because they know that if they don't go out and visit the people in their care, they're going to die. And so the people that sort of push themselves beyond their thermal tolerance tend to fall into a few categories. There are those with the awful employers that force them. Hopefully in you know, a civil society, we don't have ugly, horrible employers much anymore, but of course some will still exist. Or people that are in fear of losing their jobs. It's also people that feel responsible. You know, they're responsible like the essential services, the police, the ambulance, the district nurses, the SES who come and save you or fix your telephone poles, or the military, of course, have been another category. In fact, a lot of the early work on heat tolerance actually came out of the military, as they were finding that the soldiers were dying in training, and it was pretty difficult for the military to send letters home to their mothers saying, look, sorry, your son died. He didn't see combat. We just pushed him too hard. And so there is an upper thermal tolerance. We don't actually know what that is. There has been virtually no work done on this as far as the general working population around Australia, you know, in the world. And that's what my project's actually trying to do, and find out what strategies work, what don't work, because we're certainly going to have to change our way of thinking. Because the bottom line is that when you've got a hot place like Australia, and this is the same for all those Asian countries, the economy cannot tolerate us thinking, okay, well, it's summer, we have to down tools and industry just to shut up shop. Conversely, we can't keep pushing people until they die. And, of course, a lot of those jobs just can't be done in air-conditioned comfort. But, we really need to sort out how we're going to cope with this. And the bottom line is that if the planet keeps warming, it's going to be a real problem.
It's going to affect our whole economy. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Dr. Liz Hanna from Australian National University. She is a specialist in how the human body handles extreme heat. And as you point out, there have been studies done for the military and also for athletes, how they're going to cope, say, in the Summer Olympics. But it seems like we haven't done much about the miners, the farmers, or the people who keep our whole system going. What does need to be done?
I think we need a new mindset. There are certain tasks that we can leave till the cooler part of the day and do in, you know, the cooler times of the year. But there are certain tasks that really do need to be done. In some industries, that might mean having cool rooms where people can actually go out, do their job and come in and cool down. Because certainly, I mean, even in Australia, some jobs are done at night. As it is, a lot of the road making in summer is done at night. Picking the grapes is done at night, although I'm told that that's actually largely because it's better for the grapes rather than for the people. It's a sad reflection. I understand that in countries such as yours where you have blizzards and snow, that there's tolerance when there are blizzards and snow and people can't move. Even in places like Australia, there isn't. We don't have formalised tolerances for houses taking too long to be built or people not coming into work in those jobs that have some flexibility because of the heat. We're not taught in the health curricula about heat because it seemed to be such a rare thing and it just wasn't on the radar. And, of course, now it's something that we're just going to have to educate ourselves and actually permeate it through society, making people being aware of looking out for each other, looking out for their children, looking out for their elderly, and being tolerant on each other in terms of the workplace and expectations.
Well, Dr. Hanna, I'm assuming some industries and companies will be too slow to make the necessary changes. And will we see more occupational injuries and death due to a hotter climate, I would expect? And if so, what would that look like?
Sadly, yes, that probably is true because in an ideal world, all industries, all companies and everyone would behave perfectly. Although sadly, we realise this isn't always the case. There are some positive movements that we're seeing in Australia now, but of course, interestingly, they're the ones that are signing into being participants in my project. They're the ones that actually recognise that heat is an issue. Those that say, oh, no, not interested, they're the ones that we really do need to get to. But, of course, you can't participate in people who won't engage with you. And you wonder what their work practices are.
What does it look like at the medical level when these things happen?
There's a few things. At the light level, dehydration is a really, really key part of it because of the extra strain it puts on the body. When people get to a certain level of dehydration, and it's really at the very early stages, your cognitive function starts to diminish. This becomes really problematic if people are in charge of heavy equipment or making decisions. And this is only when you're, only a few percent, very small percent of dehydration. There's other risks such as even just sweaty hands and people's, slipping and dropping things. And so the occupational health and safety is an issue in that respect. And that can come at even sort of the early stages. In the hot places such as one of our tropical towns, Darwin, 80% of the violence happens during certain months of the year, which is called the build-up. And that's when it gets really hot and the humidity starts to kick in. And this is the male-to-male violence and the domestic violence. That's huge. It's because it becomes very oppressive. So there's mental health issues as well in terms of, violence and irritation, aggression. And physiologically, it's interesting the pathway that happens. It's, if you're fully acclimatized, obviously what our body tries to do is to kick in the thermoregulatory system, and that's when it's hot, it's largely through perspiration. So we start sweating a lot. Sweating adds to the dehydration. Given, and the other thing is, when it's hot, we try to shed heat by opening up all the skin blood vessels, which means that the volume of your blood vessels opens up a lot. So A, you're losing fluid by sweating. B, it's opening up the vessels, which, and if you increase the volume of the circulatory system, the pressure goes down, which means you really do need to drink to fill up that that volume. If you're not drinking enough, that means that your heart is working really, really hard to keep perfusing that. And if you're working or exercising or doing things, it's also trying to send a lot of blood through your muscles. At the same time, it's trying to dissipate heat by sending a lot of blood to the skin. And so it's working, that's what, it goes very, very hard, and it works very fast and very strong beats. And that's why the people that have compromised cardiac performance, they're the ones that are likely to suffer early. And of course, just in heat waves, even if people aren't actually working, it's one of the reasons why you find the elderly who are the first to succumb. But of course, that can happen to anyone who's pushing themselves too hard. And people tend not to recognize it. In a place like Australia, some of the responses we're getting from people we interview is that, look, it's just summer, get over it. You know, don't be wussy. You know, you can keep going, just, you know, soldier on. And I think this is where we need to change our mindset, in the fact that recognize that heat can kill and is killing people. In fact, it's already killing more people than the road death. And heat has killed more people in Australia than any other natural hazard ever. And this is repeated annually. And this is even prior to the increased deaths that we're having with all these extra fires and, you know, these extreme heat waves. Because, I mean, we got up to, you know, a city in Melbourne, you know, 4 million people. On the outskirts of Melbourne was just under 50 degrees. And that's 50. A city can't cope with temperatures like that. The train lines buckled, so we had to stop the trains and put people out on buses and walking in extreme heat. It's just not tenable.
And that's where we're going if we keep using fossil fuels. The United Nations has finally admitted air pollution kills people. Have you looked into the links between climate heating and air pollution and our health?
Personally, I haven't, but in the network that the research network that I was convening, a lot of my research partners are. There's many pathways that that this actually works. Part of it, of course, is the people that are living near the coal stations, or where the coal trains are rumbling past their doors and their kindergartens. There's also the burning of fossil fuels and ground-level ozone. The particulates in the air, of course, which come from any the car engines, plus certainly some of the diesel and others. And they're particularly irritating to the vessels, both in the lungs and in the heart. And so you actually find that there's, even in a single city, there's a ratio of admissions to hospital, and that's closer around the major arterial systems. So it acts in many ways to exacerbate the pre-existing, and indeed to precipitate people having respiratory and cardiac issues where prior they didn't know they had any issues. Yeah, so air pollution is a major issue. So there are so many arguments for getting off fossil fuels. There isn't any argument that we can think of that runs counter to this argument that's good for the planet and it's good for human health.
Well, that's a good point to wrap up. Our guest has been Dr. Elizabeth Hanna, an expert in global heating and human health at the Australian National University. Thank you so much, Dr. Hanna.
Absolute pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
From America's original Back to the Land, the Farm in Tennessee, this is alternative guru Albert Bates. His keynote speech at the Bioneer Chicago Great Lakes 2013 conference was recorded for Radio EcoShock by Kelly Pierce of the Chicago Independent Media Center. Here's Albert.
I'm a country boy at heart now, and I'm a long ways from home. And my friend Nicole Foss, with whom I teach permaculture courses, says, all political systems exist to concentrate wealth from the periphery to the center. Doesn't matter whether you're talking about capitalism or socialism or something else. Capitalism is simply more effective at it. Capitalism, like every other industrial economic model, is essentially a Ponzi scheme. We've had the period of boom, and now we're looking at a period of bust. We created the excess claims to underlying real wealth, as she's fond of saying. The cake is baked, and there's no avoiding its consequences. My objective of this talk is to show you a different kind of vision, one based on steady state economics that can lead us through the present turmoil and get us to a much better world for our children and our grandchildren. Now, Pam alluded to the fact that I had been an attorney for a number of years, and many years ago I was an environmental pit bull fighting bad guys. Eventually I got high blood pressure and decided being a type A individual is probably not suited to my marriage and various other things. So I retired from that. But back when I was busy taking on the nuclear industry and the chemical industry, I was confronted by a problem a little closer to home. That was the plants near us that were making agrochemicals, pesticides and herbicides and fertilizers. And they were injecting their toxic wastes into the aquifer that goes below our farm. So I looked at that, and as a lawyer, I went and read the Safe Drinking Water Act, and I said, you know, it doesn't say anything here about toxic pollutants. It says no contaminant into a safe drinking water source. And so what's going on here? And I went to protest, and we organized a group, and we filed the lawsuit, and the EPA was actually backing the chemical companies because they felt the deep well injection was better than incineration. So they were injecting toxic waste into this aquifer that goes all the way from the mountains in the east to the Gulf of Mexico. And the chemical company's essential argument was, you know, we're dumping it a mile down and nobody's going to go that deep for water. So I had two arguments to make in 1980. And those arguments were that, first, our population's growing and that there will be more need for water in the future. And secondly, climate is changing, and that will also accelerate demands on water. So I was going into a Tennessee court in 1980 trying to persuade the judge that climate change was real. And to do that, I had to troll the various agencies and scientific studies and take subscriptions to various magazines and start talking to experts and trying to line up my ducks to make this proof. And in the process, I did eventually prevail in court. We stopped the industry. We ended deep well injection in Tennessee. And actually, what did it for us was an end run around the whole court process. It was going to elect a new governor for Tennessee. And then we were on this transition team. And one of the first things we did was to work with the Department of Health and Environment to get deep well injection banned in the state of Tennessee, which actually banned fracking until recently, when the oil and gas lobby came in and said, well, we need an exemption for fracking for oil and gas. And, you know, here in Chicago or in Illinois generally, you could probably buy a state legislature. It might cost you, you know, $1 million or $10 million to buy a legislator. In Tennessee, it's cheap. You can get them for $10,000 or $25,000. Heck, if you give them $1 million, they'd come and engage in unnatural sex in your home. But, you know, it's not surprising that you're allowed to frack again now. We're completely controlled by a very strange legislature. Well, anyway, in the process, I scared myself. And Pam mentioned this book I wrote. It was a compilation of all of the data I had gotten. Al Gore wrote the foreword to the book. He had helped provide me a lot of the information. And I discussed the possibility of a runaway greenhouse where 3 degrees would take us to 4 and 4 to 5 and so on. And as we pass through these tipping points, each one would trigger a larger one. And from what we're seeing now from the kelathrate bubbles, we're committed to a significant increase. Those tipping points are being crossed. I scared myself, and I stayed scared for 20 years. These are some of the images that I drew for the book. And this was almost 30 years ago now. I talked about methane clathrates in the book, but didn't chart them. Early this year, that data became alarming as well. I had pictures of the flooding and how it would look in Bangladesh and how it would look in Long Island and New Jersey Shore and Florida and other places as storm events came and changed the coastlines. And I talked about all these things, but, you know, you can know about this, and it's a whole nother thing to actually experience it. I parked my Mini Cooper at the Nashville airport in 2010 on my way somewhere, and it was not in a flood zone. But when I came back, it had washed down the river. There hadn't been a river there before. You know, I'm not immune. And it was 10 inches of rain in 48 hours. And we've seen floods in Pakistan and England and Boulder, and hot air holds more water. Ames, Iowa had a 500-year flood in 2010 three times. You know, so knowing what's coming doesn't necessarily make you exempt or even prepare yourself all that much. Cost of preparation for me is really to build a secure eco-village on the highest ridge between Cincinnati and New Orleans and plant food and construct earth-sheltered, tornado-proof houses there. But we're at the center of the storm there. You know, you may not notice these things if you're living in a city, but if you're deeply embedded in the nature, you notice these things. Most farmers get it. And the climate that we have in Middle Tennessee today was not the climate that we had when we started the farm in 1971. That climate is now up somewhere near Lexington, Kentucky. The climate that we have today was down in Neshoba County, Mississippi in 1971. It's been moving about 40 miles per decade. It's now accelerating. It's up to about 70 miles per decade. We know this from changes of when things go into blossom in the spring and when different kinds of migrating insects and birds come. We've changed two agricultural planting zones in 40 years. Ultimately, we will need to find our way to get beyond zero. Carbon neutral will not be good enough. I've been going to UN meetings over the years, and one of the things we see there is these projections. If we wait so long, then we're going to have a steeper decline in emissions in order to stay within 1 degree or 2 degrees of warming. And actually, if you go out past 2030 or thereabouts, you actually have to get into negative emissions. Now, what does that mean? You can't just not emit. You actually have to net sequester. You have to bring more down from the atmosphere and out of the oceans each year than are going there, okay? Well, this is beyond normal scientific disciplines at this point. This is what they're calling in science hyper-wicked problems, because they're cross-cutting and embedded in the culture and the religion and the ways we do things in our society and have for thousands of years. And to become our, a future society that net sequesters carbon, half of our elected congressmen now say they don't believe in anthropogenic climate change. And they think the United Nations is a one-world conspiracy. Their scientific literacy, as well as those of our children, is declining. So all of these problems are entangled. And to address them effectively will require quantum enlargement of frame analysis and complexity science and meme science and cultural value assessments, social media measurement, neurographics, perception analysis, to develop frameworks to quantify the relationship dynamics that drive collective action. And we're a long way from even understanding what I just said. And time is closing in. And the physical world is imposing its own rules, which are actually pretty simple. So all of this is quite scary. And you would have to say that our chances of getting out of this without going extinct are really pretty slim, which is what I thought. And then, you know, and I went through this period of deep depression, and I call it my Houston moment, not because of, like, Houston, we have a problem, but because of, I was in Houston, Texas, the moment I had this, which is, we're fracked. And maybe it was already blown before I was born. Maybe this was already set in motion to the point where there was no recovery back then. So when you get to that realization, what can you possibly do? And my sense has been that if there's a little bit of hope, an ember of hope, I'm going to blow on it and try to start a fire. And really, for my own sanity, the only thing I can do is to try to do something. To try to, you know, if I'm in a sinking boat, I'm going to start bailing even if it's hopeless. And then I happened to go to a permaculture conference in Brazil, which gave me some real hope. And for the first time, I saw the Amazonian dark earths, and I started to inquire how they came into being. And that led me to the story of Francesco de Orellana and the world that he saw when he came to the Americas and was the first to travel down the Amazon River was different than portrayed by historians and anthropologists until very recently. It was not a savage world, but one as developed as Europe at that time. So I went to the textbooks. Actually, I was greatly benefited. The book that Orellana's, his journals of his travels, he had a faithful Dominican scribe named Gaspar de Carvajal. And his journey in 1542 had been daily chronicled, but it was in medieval Spanish. It had never been translated into English. But thanks to Google Books, it was available from the collection at the Library of Sevilla. And thanks to Google Translator, you can actually run it through a Spanish translator and get a reasonable approximation. And if you know a little bit about Spanish, you can translate the medieval Spanish words. Using that, I was able to actually get a picture of what he saw. And it's an interesting story because he saw this world and then he went back to Spain and he told the king and they financed a second voyage. And he traveled up the Amazon this time from the Atlantic instead of coming down from Ecuador. And he was hit by a poison arrow about 2 weeks in and died. And that was the end of that voyage. And no other Europeans arrived for another 50 years. And what happened in that 50 years, Charles Mann describes it as entire cultures hissed away like steam. Because of the first contact, the diseases spread like virus through the American peoples, and they did not have any immunity to the European diseases. And there was something like a 95% kill. This is an area of some dispute among scholars, but in the Amazon basin, it was around 95%, which means, all of art, all of culture, all of literature, all of history, everything that you have in your culture disappears. And tens of millions, perhaps hundreds of millions of people died. Some 250 domesticated species of crops were lost forever. We know this from pollen records. Consensus view was that back in Spain, they said Orellana was a liar, that what he saw was crazy, that his journals were just reports of a madman. And so they were deep six. Then they wound up in the Library of Sevilla where they just sat in cobwebs. Well, one of the things that you started to see was these reports of the Black Earths, that the basis for this rich, deep civilization that had mechanical machinery with moving parts, that had large ships that were docked along long wharf fronts in front of cities on the riversides, and the cities extended for many kilometers inland, gleaming white in the distance, and wide causeways and things like that that were in his reports. And they all vanished back into the jungle after people disappeared. And was that the basis for that civilization was its agriculture, was its ability to feed large populations, and they had these rich earths. And as I read it, I began to understand there's two man-made objects that are visible with the unaided eye if you're standing on the moon. One is the Amazon rainforest, and the other is the Sahara Desert. The two worlds collided at the Columbian encounter. European agriculture, which comes from the Fertile Crescent, northern China, northern Africa, is based on extraction. It's based on irrigation and the plow. And everywhere that began, today there are deserts. In the New World, agriculture was based on building soil. And everywhere that the populations were the densest, the soils were the deepest. This was an amazing discovery, and it's only just recently come to light in the last three decades. But it was based on agroforestry, holistic management, pasturage practices, and biochar. I'm going to talk a little bit more about this because we need this, and we need a permaculture army to make the switch, which is what I do. I train up that army. Researchers have uncovered this evidence that supports now this idea that urban societies were based around agriculture. And we know that after the depopulation and large-scale abandonment of the cities of the Americas and their subsequent reforestation, that it sequestered a huge amount of carbon from the atmosphere in a very short amount of time. In decades or centuries, it lowered the temperature of Europe to the point where they had a little ice age, and Louis XIV had to put parquet floors on the palace in Versailles to keep his feet warm. And the Swedes invaded Denmark over the ice, and Hans Brinker won the silver skates on the frozen canals. All of that as a result of this sudden sequestration of massive gigatons and gigatons of carbon from the atmosphere. You know, a similar experience happened when Genghis Khan invaded to the east, actually, or to the west. Actually, it wasn't Khan himself. He divided the Mongol Empire among his four sons. And from 1235 to 1241, they conquered most of Eastern Europe from the Urals as far east as Vienna, far west as Vienna, and then extending the empire to the gold through east through Siberia. And they exterminated the populations in many places. They were not nice people. And so there was a regrowth of forests similar to what we saw in the 15th and 16th centuries in the Americas. And it absorbed about 700 million tons of carbon from the atmosphere, which equaled the amount of carbon that global society now produces annually from gasoline. So why was the Amazon so fertile? This is, you know, why Henry Ford went and set up Fordlandia to grow rubber there. How did it manage to become so deeply fertile there at the equator, where it had been millions of years since the last glaciation? And the foreign invaders exploited these qualities, but they didn't really explain the phenomena. And it wasn't until a young man named Wim Sombroek, a Dutch soil scientist, arrived in the late 90s, he got there in the 60s as part of a UN exploration, but he didn't really explain it until the 90s. And he did all of these analyses of the soils there, and he saw something in the digs, in the archaeological digs of the soils, that reminded him of something, because Wim Sombroek was born during the Second World War, and he remembered the Hungerwinter of 1945-1946, when the European allies had not yet fully normalized in Europe. And so you had not enough food for the population. And he remembered his father in Holland going out to the garden with the cinders from his fireplace and putting them in the garden to help grow tomatoes and things in the spring. And then he was in these digs looking at pottery shards coming out of the earth, and he noticed charcoal. And he said, aha, this is like the Plaggen soils of Holland. The charcoal was used by the peoples to create fertility in their landscape, in their garden. And that is what we are today calling biochar. We haven't thought about this very much, but, you know, charcoal, what does it really do if you add it to soil? Biochar is actually a word that we're using because charcoal is a misleading term. You know, you can get it in the hardware store, you can get it in the grocery store for your barbecue, but it might have petroleum additives to make it ignite quickly and last a long time. And in fact, that's not what you want to put in your garden. So biochar refers to charcoal that's suitable for putting into a food system. It doesn't have contaminants. And so the proposed definition is a solid carbonaceous material, which is produced by the burning in the absence of oxygen. And what this does is it drives off all of the components other than the carbon. All of the volatile gases go off and get burned. And then what's left behind is hard carbon. And it's actually a crystalline kind of matrix of carbon. It's a very strong bond. It doesn't break down very easily. It doesn't become free carbon that's taken up by the plants. It's more like a soil structure carbon. And if you look at it under a microscope, you see what the value to the garden is, because it's porous. It has this pore structure that's created by the cell structure of the plant, but it's also pitted with the gases as they expand in the fire. So there are pores on the walls of the pores. And if you look down with a good enough microscope, you see pores on the walls of the pores of the walls. It's fractal. It's turtles all the way down. And so there you have, you know, it depends on what kind of plants you started with or what the temperatures were and different kinds of factors, but you get this porous structure. Well, if you're a soil microbe, if you're a bacteria or a fungi or a non-parasitic nematode or a microarthropod, you come into this structure and you see this and say, wow, a condo. I'm going to move my whole family in. And it's got high cation exchange, which essentially means the walls are magnetic for certain kinds of minerals. And so it's like painting the walls with an adhesive paint. And so as the nutrients get brought into this coral reef, they stick. And they stay there in that reef, and then the microbes, the bacteria, draw them on demand, and they provide particular nutrients on demand to the roots of the plants through the soil food web. Very quickly, as soon as the charcoal hits the ground, it immediately gets populated, and you see the fungi come in. And you see these bacteria start to fill the cavities and bring in their food sources, and the diversity skyrockets through the roof. So immediately what you see is if you have poor soil and you add biochar to it, the plants begin to grow much better. You get much stronger photosynthesis. There's available nutrients on demand. This is actually not entirely new. We had textbooks back in the mid-19th century that said, put charcoal on your tomato plants, put them on your peppers, put them on your turnips, and they'll do wonders. And this was fairly common. And with the advent of the Haber-Bosch process in the 1930s and artificial ammonium fertilizers, suddenly all of this knowledge was no longer needed. So two different kinds of carbon, and the kind that normally goes through the carbon cycle is about a 12-year cycle. You know, a plant dies, it decays in the earth, it off-gases to the atmosphere as carbon dioxide or methane, and that travels, you know, through the sky for a while. Maybe some of it gets rained down into the oceans. Some of it gets rained back to the land, and then gets taken up by the plants again and becomes next year's stalks and leaves and so forth. Well, that's the normal labile carbon cycle, typically 10, 12, 15 years. There's another kind of carbon, which is if you char something, then that forms a very hard bond, and it doesn't break down for perhaps 1,000 years. It stays in the soil, not as food, but as structure. And it's an open structure. You just saw the porous part of it, the pores. And so now you've got the potential to hold water like a sponge or air, and aerobic bacteria love that. So you have the carbon capacity to begin to do this structural effect. And if you look at carbon reservoirs, where they exist in the earth and in the water and in the oceans and so forth, let's take a small exercise. It's an exercise in holistic thinking. So you're going to be to think like a piece of Gaia's new neocortex. You have four organs that you're balancing for carbon, and nitrogen and phosphorus and potassium and other elements too. And you have to keep them all in balance. But let's start with carbon now. Fossil fuel combustion will release 30 billion tons of carbon dioxide this year. If that was phased out over 40 years on a straight line basis, a total of 580 billion tons would still be released before emissions stop completely by 2050, say. Deforestation is releasing 7 billion tons a year. If it proves possible to stop that in 10 years, it will add 35 billion tons to the atmosphere by 2020. If we ignore other releases from the way we use and abuse the land, including methane from cattle, and we keep those and we keep the rice we grow, and the nitrous oxide from fertilizers we apply, we're looking at adding another 615 billion tons of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere by mid-century, even with an incredibly aggressive emissions mitigation program. Now, that's 615 billion tons of carbon dioxide that'll have to be removed together with the excess carbon dioxide that's already up there. So suppose we take 350 parts per million as our initial target, as James Hansen and others suggest. At present, 2.9 trillion tons of carbon dioxide. So reducing its concentration from 400 to 350 means we have to take about 300 billion tons out. Okay, so these are our best options. And we can find that we can get our 8 to 10 gigatons of carbon from these wedges. This is how much per year you can get out using carbon farming, like Vandana Shiva suggests, emissions reductions like the UN's working so hard to accomplish, afforestation, reforestation, and biochar. And afforestation, reforestation is another big one. So plant trees, grow fruit trees, grow nut trees, change the city trees to things that produce food, that kind of thing. These are our best options, and we can find that we can get it, but we have to work in coordinated ways. And can we be sure that they will work? One of the things I learned in the process of experimenting and taking what I learned in Brazil back to the farm in Tennessee and starting to make biochar and put it in my garden was that there's an important piece that they don't often tell you about, which is that actually, if you just put charcoal in your garden for the first year or two, the plants will probably do worse. Why is that? Well, it's because they need to fill up all those rooms in the condo with the bacteria and the nematodes and all their nutrients. So they're stealing all of that from the garden to fill up the soil reef. And what you need to do first, actually, is put the charcoal in your compost pile. And then it fills up with everything that's needed for the garden. And then you put it in the garden, and suddenly you get this beautiful growth. Everything does wonderfully. So we started doing this at the farm, and then we got into compost teas. Now, compost teas is a whole other step. So instead of just the compost, which is very rich in nutrients, we want to get the biology amped up. So we want to get those, all of those bacteria and fungi, all the aerobic kinds that are really good for gardens, all going really strong before we get them into the garden. And so to do that, we brew them in aerobic water at a particular warm temperature, and we get them going really strong over about a 24-hour period, and then we put that in the garden. So I got a little video here I want to show you. This is our latest stuff that we've been doing in that department. So if we have soil minerals and we have a wide range of them, and then we have bacteria and fungi, they can choose and they can become what's needed for the roots of, or what's demanded by the roots of particular plants. For, you know, if you have stress from a drought or you have different soil deficiencies, you can begin to redress those if you have the available gene pool that's there that the bacteria and the fungi can choose from. So we saw that diversity slide of all the DNA and how it explodes in a bacterial coral reef. Well, if we can do that, then we can create these systems for making more better plant growth and photosynthesis. The plants themselves store more nutrients. If you're talking about food plants, they become more nutritious. They become more nutrient dense. They have a wider array of nutrients. And so that same epigenetic effect happens in your gut. When you absorb all of that nutrient availability, you're also absorbing a lot of bacteria. You are made up of a huge amount of bacterial DNA, each and every one of you. And so you have all of that available, and as you do food preparation, you're adding in more. You know, if you have beer or bread or pickles or any number of things, you're using fermentation, and what's that? That's bacteria. That's different processes to create more available life forms that you're ingesting. This is the agriculture of the Americas. This is the agriculture that we give to the world. It was a whole systems in which the nutrients were returned to the places where they originated rather than exported upriver or across an ocean or by rail or by large semi-tractor trailers to some distant city and then wind up in the sewage treatment plant, which goes into the river. No, it's going back to the fields. It's actually recycling back. And so the takeaways essentially for me are that you have this whole soil food web that is the basis of our life. And we need to think about this in biological terms, not chemical terms. We've been reducing everything, you know, Liebig's law of moving everything to the, you know, what's the critical elements that we need to get into our diet or into our food supply or so forth. No, what we really need to think about are what are the critical biology factors that make for resilience in ecosystems. Okay, then the next question is, how do we get buy-in? How do we get people to actually go for this system over the existing systems that are so heavily sponsored by industry and governments? And my concept is to look at this, what I'm calling cool food, and hoping to create as a cool food movement. And examples, this is the largest CSA in Europe, the largest subscription agriculture system. 25,000 subscribers buy from this one farmer. And he has a biochar-producing heating kiln, which also has a Stirling engine on it. So it produces 5 kilowatts or 25 kilowatts of power. And then it produces all of the electricity needed for the fans and the lights and everything else in his farm, pumps and whatnot. And then he also produces heat that keeps his greenhouses going all through the winter. So he has a four-season harvest for all of his subscribers. And he's making biochar. So the biochar then goes back into his plants, which then become nutrient dense. if you look at problems that they've been having in Japan as the population ages there, the Satoyama, which literally means second nature, was the area outside of the farms where farmers would go to get bamboo or hunt or various other things. And now there's not enough young farmers. They've all gone off to the city. And the old farmers don't use the Satoyama as much. And so it's become overgrown, and the wild boars come and they ravage the rice paddies. And so a group of farmers banded together in the Hozu Farmer Co-op, and they created a biochar-making system where they would harvest the bamboo out of the Satoyama to keep the wild boars from growing too much. Then they would turn that into biochar, put it into their fields, and then they started branding the food. So they were growing cabbages made in biochar, and they knew that they were net sequestering carbon in the process. So they called it cool food, and they sold mixes of cool slaw in the stores at a slight premium, and they sold out. And so they surveyed the buyers of these things, and they found that the consumers were largely families that had children, and the children were telling their parents, buy this, it will help save the planet. And in fact, they started marketing then to children by having cartoons and comic books and things talking about Mr. Biochar and the things that he does in the garden, and how you can carbon sequester while having higher nutrient density in your food. So this is a whole systems model for industry to be able to look at cool products, right? So Craig Sams, who founded Green and Blacks, is now in Belize. He's working with the Toledo Cacao Growers Organic Association that's making organic chocolate. And they're taking the cacao pods, which is a waste product of the industry, putting it into kilns and making biochar that goes back into the cacao orchards to make the cacao orchards more resilient and nutrient dense. And then they're making charcoalite. Cesar Velez in Mexico doing the same thing with making agave, and he's producing what in the future may be called charquila. So that's cool foods. Now also think about cool fuels. We have the possibility here. This is the village. It's an eco-village in Ireland, and they have district heating, Ireland's first eco-village, 30 homes in a village and 20 more in the adjoining older village. And what they want to do is replace Polish coal, which is the traditional Irish way of heating their homes, and endangered peat with a facility that takes 40 acres of pelletized biomass annually. Well, if they put in and switch over their boilers, and they're working with the European Commission to get a grant to do this, and make biochar using a pyrolytic instead of an oxidizing burn, they can actually reduce their demand for pellets by 30%. And so they use less acreage every year to make the biomass. And they can actually work it from waste crops, waste stubble from corn and wheat and so forth, and sawdust from sawmills and other kinds of waste products that, if left on their own, would become carbon dioxide in the atmosphere or methane. So they're using the biochar that they would produce from, and they're already producing biochar, from home and community gardens throughout County Tipperary. And they contract with local farmers, and they return a lot of the biochar to them. So here's a way that you can actually do this, making your own biochar stove that you can put into your wood stove. If you have a wood burner, a wood heater, you just have to make a cylinder, puncture some holes so that the gases can escape, have a tight-fitting lid. I put a screw on one end, and then I have an eyelet on the other end so I can lift it out of the fire when it's hot. I fill it with bamboo. I throw it in my wood stove. I make biochar, and then it gases. And you see the little blue jets coming out of the side of the stove. And then you know that it's making gas, and it's also producing charcoal. And then as soon as the blue gas stop, then I know that it's done. I take it out. I cool it off, throw it out in the snow, bring it back in, unscrew it, put in more bamboo, and start it again. I'm using less biomass. I'm using waste products, sawdust, cardboard, things that I can't use that would otherwise decay or be burned in a landfill. And then take that and then make biochar, which then goes into my garden in the spring. We're also doing carbon farming courses. I'm now calling them climate farming courses. And we've got this model built to where we're doing these courses with other people providing them all over the world, in the Caribbean, in Costa Rica, and other places. My thrust that I try to tell people is what we really want to do is get these so that they're not just one process. You're using that heat, you're using that product, and you're passing it through many stages. In permaculture, we call this multiple yields or stacked yields. So you have water treatment with the charcoal. Then you have a silage conditioner where that same charcoal goes to into the silage to prevent bad toxins and fungus from coming in. And then you have digestive supplements. So it goes into the cows through the silage, and it helps their seven stomachs to digest properly. And then you have a litter amendment. It's going into their manure, which is going into the barn, and then it has going into a manure conditioner, which becomes a soil amendment, which sequesters the carbon. I'll mention cool houses because now I'm getting to the stage where I want to talk about eco-villages. And cool houses are like, okay, straw bale. And we want to replace these subdivisions with which are energy intensive with buildings that are have low embodied energy, cob, earth bags, ways of building with nature using natural materials that do not require a mortgage to build with that anybody can learn to do with the ground beneath their feet and the things that grow around them. And you can begin to make these climate ready. So you have living roofs. And we can see this in urban settings as well, the use of living roofs to sequester carbon, provide temperature control, and various other good features. So this is Earth Haven community in North Carolina, earth sheltered and tree sheltered to reduce the need for heating and air conditioning by using natural elements in the landscape. We're actually now experimenting with putting biochar into wall plasters. What does it do? It draws mold spores out of the air and sequesters them in the reef, in the wall, and actually cleans the air. So it's biobiology. It actually is healthy building syndrome. This is now becoming what we call the eco-village vision. Because I think Pam mentioned the idea of sustainability plus, and this is a big part of what we talk about. It's the quintessentia of eco-village. The earliest eco-village that we know of is Solheimr in Iceland, started in 1930 by a woman named Cecilia Sigmund's daughter. She's now on an Icelandic postage stamp. Cecilia was fortunate enough to buy a farm that had a hot well. It produced hot water at almost 12 gallons per second. At almost boiling temperatures. And so with that, she built greenhouses. And today, they are reforesting Iceland from that eco-village, making more than 1 million trees a year, putting back the trees that the Danes and others took away in centuries to make charcoal for European stoves. They're reforesting Iceland with geothermal power. Note the living roofs on all of those buildings. Dominur in Italy is a federation of eco-villages in the Vedraccio Valley in northern Italy. And they're reestablishing the old cultures of cheese and wine and other kinds of good things. Sarvodaya in Sri Lanka, 18,000 eco-villages in their network. They have a self-help pay-it-forward program where one village adopts another and tries to bring that village up to the same living standards as the first village. So wealthy villages have an obligation to adopt poorer ones and bring them up to the same basic standards. You have Japan is probably the newest member of the eco-village network. They have different kinds of cuisine. They're exploring perennial grasses to make udon noodles and things to create new ways of living in Japan. This is quite a challenge given Fukushima. At the farm in Tennessee, we talk about the three-legged stool. So you have to be ecologically sustainable. You have to be sustainable from the standpoint of social dynamics. You have to be able to live with each other in ways that are egalitarian and transparent and so forth. But also, you need to be economically sustainable, something that's often overlooked. So the farm today, another major thing we're doing is sequestering carbon through our footprint. We have grown from an original 750-acre purchase in 1971 to more than 5,000 acres under management today. And most of that is zoned for human exclusion. This is what I see as the future, is carbon-negative villages and settlements around the world, each of them sequestering more than they actually produce. And we're giving workshops now in China with the Global Eco-Village Network and Gaia University to create future designs in China, which provide trainings in how to build villages of this kind. This is our idea, you know, to de-link growth from well-being, to do it immediately and not wait. You have to ask, how do people evolve? How does society change? It changes by example. It changes by carrot, not stick. Sticks always have a reverse blowback effect. Carrots, on the other hand, create permanent change. You look at how others are doing things and you learn and say, I would like to live that way. I would like to do things that way. In Africa, one of our eco-village projects in Senegal is now working with the United Nations and the Global Environmental Facility to plant trees. They're working to set up an international accord across Africa where they're going to plant trees all the way from the Atlantic Ocean to the Indian Ocean and to slowly roll back the Sahara Desert going from south to north. They have an eco-village network in Senegal now that has a ministry for eco-villages in the government and a minister of eco-villages in the government of Senegal with a goal of 18,000 eco-villages by the end of this decade in Senegal to do this tree planting work. So this is our vision. This is how we work. And this is the real wealth. The real question, the only question I have left is how do we get fast buy-in? How do we get more people to do this quickly? And my sense of it is that we need to make it a viral meme that spreads very infectiously, fungal meme. And so it has to be cool. And so I'm talking about e-cool villages, e-coolnomics, e-cool foods, cool fuels, cool energy systems. If we could get, you know, devices that could go in every home and every backpack, this would be the way to do it, you know? And so, cool living. And if you all come down and visit us at the Eco Village Training Center at the farm, I'll be happy to show you some of what we're doing. So please, join us.
We are totally out of time. Download this program and all our programs as free MP3s at our website, ecoshock.org. I'm Alex. Thank you for listening.
FM. I'm hearing Phil Taylor, so that must be me. Today we're going to talk about a little bit about the Brexit, and we're going to be speaking to Des Dalton of Republican Sinn Féin to get a take on matters from Dublin. And we will also be talking to about NATO in this latest meeting that took place in Warsaw. Kind of a dangerous, certainly troubling business. We're going to talk to Murray Dobbin about that. Canada is behaving sort of, I guess the Americans would say, no surprise, but some Canadians probably are registering a bit of surprise that Trudeau is not quite the personality, the type of personality they thought he was. And that toward the end of the program, the latter third, we will talk to Zafar Bangash, Crescent -international.net, and Zafar knows a great deal about the war in Syria, the problems of Turkey, the new relationship between Erdogan and the Russians. We hope he can explain that. We know he's probably studied enough psychology to be able to help us out. Mr. Erdogan is someone who, the more you listen to him, the more you wonder if he has professional help. Anyway, I will say that more power to Black Lives Matter. I think they're doing wonderful work, and I know there's a great deal of talk, and I can't think of a better leadership. I don't think anybody's been more courageous, more on point than they have. And in these times, we really appreciate the great work that they do. And but now I believe we're joined by the president of Republican Sinn Féin, Des Dalton. Are you there, Des?
Hello. Sorry, Phil. Yes, indeed. I'm here.
I think a committee member answered before you did. It's good to have you. Now, I want to remind everybody, you're president of Republican Sinn Féin. You've been watching closely these events, and I was very impressed by the statement that has been issued. People can find it, I believe, at rsf.ie. Your assessment is to say, to initiate this, is that there's nothing to be alarmed about. This is probably going to work to the good, the British referendum. Tell us what you've had to say about that.
Yes, well, I think on a number of levels, from an Irish Republican perspective, I think yes, there's a lot of positives to be garnered from all of this. I think on the first level, and this is from probably strictly an Irish Republican perspective, we would see it as a destabilisation, if you like, of the so-called United Kingdom, which from our perspective, as is quite obvious, is only to the good. I think what it has done is, once again, it has exposed the inherent contradictions that lie within that particular constitutional entity. And that's evidenced by the fact now that the Scottish First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, is already now repeating calls now for a new Scottish referendum independence because of the fact that the Scottish people voted one particular way, whereas the English voted another, but yet it's the English vote that prevails. And likewise for the six northeastern counties of Ireland, showing that democratic deficit that lies at the heart of the so-called United Kingdom. So I think it has exposed all of that, and I think it has, if you like, put a very decisive fault line through all of that. Outside of that, and on a broader level, again, looking at the EU as a political project, and I think this is one of the unfortunate aspects, if you like, of Brexit, is that the right, if you like, the people like the Nigel Farages and so on, and UKIP, were allowed to frame the debate. There is a very progressive left socialist argument against the EU, which wasn't probably properly articulated, but it is still there nonetheless, and nonetheless valid. And it's one that Irish Republicans have consistently put forward within Ireland over the last 40, 50, 60 years against the EU project. We see it as fundamentally undemocratic, a huge centralisation of power. And what it has become over the last 25 or 30 years is a neoliberal economic monolith, which we can see the effects of it over the last 5 or 6 years. The people of Greece have felt it. The people of Ireland have felt it. Working class people throughout Europe have felt the effects of all of that. So from all of those aspects, I think anything that weakens both of those on democratic unions, I think, is only to be seen as a positive.
I was very glad. You also emphasize there's this. The EU has been kind of growing without any sort of second thought. I mean, they take in new members. They have a military aspect to them, which is, as we can see this with the Warsaw meeting, rather dangerous.
Oh, absolutely, yes. And I mean that meeting has thrown that to the forefront. I mean, it's something that, you know, our own political establishment here in Ireland have been trying to downplay, and their presence at that, they've been trying to downplay, even though ostensibly this southern Irish state, the 26 county state, is neutral. You know, we can see the lie that's been given to that, the fact that US warplanes have been using Shannon for a long number of years to support the imperialistic wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, highlight all of that. And yes, there has been an ongoing project of constructing an EU superstate and a militarized superstate that, you know, I mean, Jacques Delors, the then European Commissioner back in the early 1990s, talked about the EU having to fight the resource wars of the 21st century. And we have seen that played out by its presence in a number of conflicts around the world, where it's being siding with you know, with NATO-led forces in exactly doing that, consolidating Western European interests over those of the developing world. So all of that is part and parcel of what the EU project is about. Mm-hmm. And within Europe, as I've said already, we see that it's certainly not something that's been in the interest of ordinary people, but those of the, you know, the neoliberal economic elite.
This is Des Dalton. He's the president of Republican Sinn Féin, rsf.ie for the statements and other materials. I was a little surprised. You point out that the right was permitted to sort of take the lead, but historically the left and certainly Sinn Féin, Republican Sinn Féin, and going all the way back to Connolly, was leery of these things. Were you surprised that that so many took a back seat and allowed this to be the argument to be defined by right-wing forces?
Yes, it was very disappointing. And particularly, we say, looking from a British context, somebody like Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the British Labour Party, who himself would have very much come from that tradition. I know with people like his political mentor, Tony Benn, would have been one of the leaders or most articulate exponents of those arguments. And obviously within an Irish context, we've seen provisional Sinn Féin, led by Gerry Adams, doing a complete volte-face, not for the first time, obviously, as you're more than well aware, Phil. They've already done it on an Irish basis in terms of the Republican position and their attitude towards British rule in Ireland. But now they've gone, you know, they've broadened that out now to obviously not only embracing British rule, but now they've embraced the EU, we'll say the new imperialism of the EU. And all of that, yes, absolutely, was disappointing. And I think there was an abrogation, if you like, of responsibility by elements of the left in not coming forward to do that, by allowing, if you like, those forces which traditionally would have been the biggest supporters of the EU project for many years on the right to take a lead and take a lead on issues such as migration, such on very xenophobic, very narrow arguments. I mean, as I said to you, there's plenty of really strong progressive democratic arguments to be made. And unfortunately, they weren't made by the people that should have been doing so.
Yeah, I have from your text here, it says, we're proud of our record of consistently opposing the construction of a militarized and undemocratic superstate in every referendum held in the 26 counties since the original referendum on membership of the EEC in 1972. You know, people, it's almost like they were opposed, and then they began to sleepwalk into this. And the principles on which they were opposed haven't changed. But was it Blairism? Was it getting nice paychecks or being a member? Or what caused that?
Exactly. That's a very good way to describe it, Phil. That's exactly what it's been. It's a process of assimilation, I suppose. And it's something that, if you want to chart with Provisional Sinn Féin, the Gerry Adams-led organisation, no more than their initial embracing of British rule, it's done incrementally, it's done in stages, and it begins with a protest about this whole project. But I always think this is the key phrase: we need to engage. First of all, it was the need to engage with British rule. Then we need to engage with the EEC. So we need to, if we are elected, we need to take our seats in the European Parliament, and we need to engage in this process. And it's a critical engagement is always the one, if you like. I think that's always the warning sign. But that critical engagement then very much becomes becoming part of that system, of taking positions within it. And suddenly the system itself becomes something that needs to be protected and defended because, as you say, the salaries, the dependency on it and so on. And ultimately, you know, historical revolutionary experience and the lessons of history show that you do not change these systems from within. They change you fundamentally and ultimately, and that's what happens. Yeah. And that's what has happened in these situations.
Yeah, it's not a comfortable job. We're speaking to Des Dalton, president of Republican Sinn Féin, and again, it's rsf.ie. And, you made many good points in the statement, and one that certainly resonates with me. I noticed you mentioned Tony Benn. Now, his son, Hillary Benn, I'm only aware of two speeches by him in the past year. One of them, the last time I saw him on his feet, he was calling for the bombing of Syria and as though it were a sacred cause that Britain had to do. And the next time I saw him on his feet, he was saying Jeremy Corbyn had to go. And by the way, on that point, if you call for the bombing of a sovereign country such as Syria, and particularly if you come from the Republican tradition, isn't that absolutely a splitting issue where you say, well, look, we're out of here. Is people going to talk about bombing other countries? You know, there isn't any basis to be in such an institution as the EU if they're going to say that it's all right to commit aggression.
Absolutely. And you have to ask what's your red line in those situations. And indeed, yes, even on, and I don't like reducing any of these things to the level of the personal or the personality, but it did sadden me to see somebody like Hillary Benn coming from the tradition he came from. And Tony Benn, from my own perspective, was always somebody I would have had great admiration for. And as a British politician or an English politician, I always saw him as one of those very progressive, you know, part of that great and very noble English tradition of progressive Republican politics. But yes, indeed, you do have to wonder what is the bottom line for any of these people, and how sincerely held are any of the other so-called quote-unquote values that they espouse, because on something as fundamental, as you say, as bombing a sovereign nation, yes, and attempting to interfere with its own processes, you know, well, once you're willing to accept that, then really, I think, you know, all bets are off at that stage.
Yeah, certainly. Well, I would like to see more people talk about the matters that you take up, which is, what is our fundamental position? What is, with whom would we unite, and where would we draw red lines against cooperation, particularly if you're going to create a super state? But as you say, actually now we're in a phase of what's going to be a radical change. And, of course, it's rather unpredictable situation. But you go and you conclude with the reminder that the Republican Sinn Féin has been for a community of free nations, as envisaged by James Connolly. And with such a community of free nations, all Ireland, Federal Democratic Socialist Republic could take its rightful place. Talk a little bit about James Connolly and what his concept was.
Well, again, we talk about democracy and how it operates, and obviously, one of our key arguments against the EU is the lack of democracy, democratic accountability, mm-hmm, and the centralization of power. So, on a national level, first of all, you know, we would argue, and the progressive argument against the EU is that the most fundamental democratic unit at which that kind of democracy can exist is the nation state, and within the nation state, then, you know, a maximum decentralization of political power decision making, you know, from the national right down from an Irish context, the provincial, the regional, the local, the community. And then within nations, between nations, we wish to see that not only democracy within nations, but between nations. So that there, yes, absolutely, it's not some kind of isolationist, narrow concept we would have. I mean, Irish Republicans are very much international in the best sense of that word. So we want to see international cooperation. We, for instance, the Celtic nations of Ireland, Scotland, Wales, hopefully maybe a free Brittany and Cornwall and the Isle of Man, that there would be a league there, much under, say, the Nordic model, the Nordic League model. A basis of mutual cooperation, of mutual benefit, and likewise within Europe, and indeed, but not confined to Europe, but also maybe something that, an equal and democratic interaction between the developing and the developed world and so on. And all of that's the kind of vision that Connolly talked about, that kind of international democracy, a democracy between nations and between peoples. Yeah. And I think that's the vision
outlook,
that
is it
we
not?
Need for the 21st century.
Yeah, it's one that respects other people, but particularly working people. And the concept is do no harm. You don't beggar your neighbor. You care about your neighbor.
Absolutely, yes. That's indeed. And you know, that kind of cooperation and that willingness to work and to look out for each other, I think, is a fundamental part of what we are as human beings.
Yes. Well, Des Dalton, it's great to talk to you, President of Republican Sinn Féin. Thank you very, very much. We look forward to talking to you again in the future about these developments.
You too, Phil. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.
And that's Des Dalton, the President of Republican Sinn Féin. You're listening to Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. We're going to hear a little bit of Phil Oakes, and we're going to come back with Murray Dobbin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Ben Beachy, Senior Policy Advisor with the Sierra Club's Responsible Trade Program, who discusses his group's response to leaked documents related to the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. Pilar Schiavo, an organizer with National Nurses United, who explains why her union supports Medicare for All, and the struggle to have the Democratic Party adopt universal health care in their party platform. And Craig Aaron of the media democracy group Free Press, who talks about a recent federal appeals court ruling that upheld the FCC's net neutrality rules protecting an open internet. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Wisconsin's legislative redistricting map, which was used by Governor Scott Walker to consolidate his right-wing agenda, is now being challenged in federal court. The case argues that Republican leaders in the Badger State used redistricting to make it difficult for Democrats and progressives to block Walker's regressive agenda. If the lawsuit prevails in appeals court, the case, Whitford versus Nickel, could upend other Republican-drawn redistricting maps in states like Michigan, Ohio, Virginia, and Texas. Many legal observers think the case may come before the U.S. Supreme Court. Michael Lee, a lawyer for the Brennan Center for Justice, told the American Prospect the Wisconsin lawsuit is the most significant gerrymandering case in 30 years. The Wisconsin legislative map, which took effect in 2011, was designed in a closed-door meeting held at the offices of the Republican-leaning law firm Michael Best and Friedrich. The plan was so secret that GOP legislators had to sign a confidentiality agreement to look at it. The redistricting plan was passed by the state legislature after a single hearing. Opponents filed a lawsuit, and a three-judge panel slapped the Michael Best law firm with a $17,000 fine. But the Republican map has done its job very well. In the 2012 state assembly election, Democrats won 200,000 more votes than Republicans, but due to the strategically drawn maps, the GOP maintained control of the legislature with a 60-39 seat majority. Millions of low-wage California workers will celebrate in 2022 when the minimum wage is due to be increased to $15 an hour. Yet tens of thousands of part-time workers may still be mired in poverty since they rely on stringing together several part-time jobs to make ends meet. According to The Nation magazine, over 160,000 hourly workers in Silicon Valley are underemployed and forced to work multiple jobs. Half of these low-wage part-time service workers often earn lower hourly wages than full-time workers. According to the Community Labor Coalition Silicon Valley Rising, many part-time workers often don't know their work schedules week to week. As a result, they have a tough time saving money or spending time with their children. Moreover, few get any vacation days or the opportunity to earn retirement benefits. To bring economic stability to their part-time workforce, Silicon Valley Rising is pushing for San Jose voters to consider their Opportunity to Work initiative in a ballot measure this November. The proposal, if approved, would compel employers to offer full-time work to current part-time employees before they can hire new part-time workers. Russian tourists are returning to the Black Sea for summer relaxation as terrorism and geopolitics have cut off favorite vacation spots in Egypt and Turkey. Sochi, the site of the 2014 Winter Olympics, and the recently annexed Crimea Peninsula have gained new popularity for tourists, even if these locations lack the facilities many affluent Russians had been accustomed to in the Middle East. Tourists are also returning to out-of-the-way places like the breakaway region of Abkhazia. When the Soviet Union broke up in the early 1990s, middle-class Russians discovered resorts in Turkey and Egypt. But now, these summer destinations are too dangerous. In recent years, Sochi has seen several million more tourists arrive, staying at hotels and spas built for the Olympics. The Crimea has been a summer retreat for Russia's elite since Tsarist times. Since Russia's annexation of the territory and the ongoing civil war in eastern Ukraine, tourists are returning to Crimea in large numbers. The Russian government is investing heavily in Crimea's tourist industry, including the construction of a new road and rail bridge, which will be the longest bridge in Europe when it's finished by the end of 2018. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Among the free trade deals being negotiated by the U.S. in the remaining months of Barack Obama's presidency are the controversial Trans-Pacific Partnership and the less well-known, but equally controversial, Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP. TTIP, if ratified, will create the world's largest free trade zone. But with Britain's vote to leave the European Union, the future of TTIP is now in doubt, as the Conservative government of outgoing UK Prime Minister David Cameron had been an important ally of the US in EU trade negotiations. After the 13th round of TTIP negotiations in May, Greenpeace Netherlands leaked 248 pages of classified documents covering two-thirds of the areas discussed at the secret trade talks. Critics of the trade deal say the documents reveal that if ratified, TTIP could lower EU standards in areas such as the environment and public health by giving U.S. companies the right to lobby the EU to make sure regulations do not stand in the way of U.S. corporate profits. Specific concerns relate to the possible erosion of EU regulations on climate change, food labeling, and approval of dangerous chemicals and pesticides, a claim denied by U.S. and EU trade negotiators. Your reporter spoke with Ben Beachy, senior policy advisor with the Sierra Club's Responsible Trade Program, who discusses his group's concern about the leaked documents and what they reveal about Washington's apparent goal to weaken environmental and climate protections.
The Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership is really cleaved out of much of the same mold as the highly controversial Trans-Pacific Partnership. It's not as far along in negotiations, but from what we've seen, from what leaks, and there was just a big leak last week, we can see that many of the rules that are now finalized in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which still has to go before our Congress, are exactly what's being negotiated in the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, the one with the EU, which the acronym is, it really is alphabet soup. The acronym is TTIP for the EU deal. So TTIP has a lot of the same rules, and in some ways those rules would pose at least as much danger to U.S. climate policies if they were enshrined in an agreement with the EU as those that are in the TPP. And I can get to some specifics, but in one particular area that we're quite concerned about are these provisions that would grant new rights to fossil fuel corporations that are based in the European Union to challenge our climate protections, not in any court, but in private tribunals that are not accountable to any domestic legal system. And we've seen fossil fuel corporations increasingly using these provisions to go after climate protections and other environmental policies. And this would be really an unprecedented expansion of liability for our climate protections in the history of U.S. trade deals.
Well, I wonder if you'd summarize for us the reasons for rising opposition to the TTIP or TTIP in Europe, which has certainly been fueled by the recent leak by Greenpeace Netherlands of 248 pages of documents from the proposed trade agreement. I guess we can ask you to review what these documents say, which have contributed in large part to many opponents' worst fears about what this trade agreement is all about.
That's right. They really have. I mean, so I looked over all 248 pages, and climate change is not mentioned once in the leaks from last week. It's not the full text, but it's a large portion of the text. While it does not mention climate change, it does include a wide array of rules that would restrict the tools that the U.S. and the EU could use to tackle climate change. As one example, one set of rules that was revealed in the leaks is something that the U.S. and the EU have proposed called regulatory cooperation, and that sounds nice. But there are rules that would undermine our climate and environmental protections if they would be deemed harmful to transatlantic trade or investment. As an example, the U.S. has actually proposed rules in that chapter that would allow corporations, including fossil fuel firms, to petition a government for the, quote, repeal of a regulation. On the basis that it has been become more burdensome than necessary to achieve its objective, given its impact on trade. That is, it may well be that you have a legitimate objective to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, reduce climate pollution. But if a corporation, a fossil fuel corporation, thinks, well, you know, that's all well and good, but it has this, you know, it has a large impact on our ability to invest across the Atlantic, or a large ability on our ability to trade fossil fuels across the Atlantic Ocean, then they could petition for the repeal of that regulation using this trade agreement. So that's, you know, that's under the guise of so-called regulatory cooperation. What it really does is this so-called regulatory cooperation gives a new seat at the table for industry, including fossil fuel firms, to try to conform our policymaking process on both sides of the Atlantic to their interests, which again are fundamentally opposed to the goal of moving beyond fossil fuels and embracing a transition to 100% clean energy.
What are some of the issues here you think that could derail this trade agreement? Or do you think U.S.-European negotiators will eventually overcome their differences?
Yeah, it's a good question. If the leaks are any indication, they're nowhere close to overcoming the differences. And even if they would overcome those differences, they're nowhere close to overcoming what has become an extremely broad-based opposition in the EU, and I would say growing opposition here in the United States. You know, it'd be one thing if these trade deals were just actually about trade, about goods moving across borders, but these are trade deals that are writing rules that will have a fundamental impact on our daily lives, on the safety of our food, on the affordability of our medicines, and on the stability of our climate.
That was Ben Beachy, Senior Policy Advisor with the Sierra Club's Responsible Trade Program. Learn more about why there's growing opposition to the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership Agreement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. During the Democratic presidential primary campaign, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders outlined many policy differences with former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Under his call for a political revolution against the power of the 1%, some of the specific differences revolved around student debt, trade policy, and health care. And while Clinton changed her position months ago on trade policy, stating that she now opposes the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, and has moved much closer to Sanders' call for free tuition at public colleges and universities, there has not yet been a meeting of the minds on health care. In debates, Sanders called for a universal single-payer program, also known as Medicare for All, that would cover every American, while Clinton repeated her claim that establishing such a system would put Obamacare in jeopardy. Some of Sanders' earliest and staunchest supporters were members of National Nurses United, the largest union of registered nurses in the U.S., which itself has long called for a Medicare for All type health care plan. Roseanne DeMauro, executive director of National Nurses United, was appointed by Senator Sanders to the Democratic Party Platform Committee to represent his views on health care, but she was rejected by the Democratic National Committee. Subsequently, a plank to include support for Medicare for All was defeated by a 7-6 vote, with Hillary Clinton's representatives on the committee opposing the measure. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Pilar Schiavo, an organizer with National Nurses United. Here she explains why her union supports Medicare for All and the struggle to have the Democratic Party adopt universal health care, not only as a right, but to spell out how the country can achieve that goal.
Medicare for All is a very simple solution. It just means that instead of having to wait until you're 65 to get a Medicare card, that you would get it when you're born. We already have Medicare. It's been around for, it's about to celebrate its 51st birthday. It provides health care to 20% of our population, which uses 80% of our health care and is still, you know, afloat and successful. So if we were to add everybody into that, we know it would be a successful program. And, you know, it's a lot of the cost savings, we can also improve upon it because, you know, Republicans have worked to really try and chip away and are constantly trying to privatize it. We always talk about wanting improved Medicare for all to make sure that it's a comprehensive benefit for everyone. So it's not something that would actually be just for those folks who can't afford healthcare or be something. It's separate from the ACA. It would be the new healthcare system, just like the ACA is our current healthcare system, right? It would be a step forward to finish the job of healthcare reform, to ensure that actually everybody has access to healthcare when they need it. Instead of right now, the reality is people have access to healthcare when they can afford it. So we're talking about healthcare as a right, and the Democratic Party, you know, and their platform have confirmed that healthcare should be a right. Then making it a right means that people can access it when they need it and not just when they can afford it.
When the Bernie appointees pushed for Medicare for All to be in the platform, it was voted down 6-7 with all of the Bernie appointees plus Barbara Lee in support of it and all of the Hillary appointees voting against it. And, you know, there was a really good response, I think, from Cornel West that kind of went viral on the internet, where he called them out because, you know, after that vote happened, people started talking about, you know, Bernie Sanders has done so much to move the issue forward of healthcare as a right, and we should reaffirm that. And Cornel West correctly pointed out that this is not just about words saying healthcare is a right. This is about actions and making real change that actually makes healthcare as a right a reality. And so to say that you support healthcare as a right and then vote down Medicare for All that could actually make healthcare a right is contradictory. And so, you know, that's kind of where the divide is right now within the platform, is that, you know, there's some good language that sounds good and sounds like the Democratic Party is supportive of healthcare as a right, but how are they going to get there? This is something that 81% of Democrats support, a Medicare for All like system. There's no reason that Democrat leadership wouldn't be supporting it. And until they do, you know, people are going bankrupt, they're dying, and they're waiting for the Democratic leadership to catch up with them.
Pilar Schiavo, there was a breakthrough last week between the Sanders and Clinton campaigns around the issue of free college education, where Hillary has now said she'd support free public college for families making under $125,000 a year. You haven't heard of any such breakthrough on the issue of Medicare for All?
We know that there are conversations going on around healthcare with the Bernie campaign and Hillary's campaign. And as of now, I don't know that there's been any resolution to that. So it's unfortunate because Secretary Clinton used to be a single-payer supporter. She used to talk about this as the solution for a very long time. And it's until this, you know, primary season that she decided to really kind of turn on the issue, and in a lot of ways, I think, has made it very difficult for herself to come back around and support it, because she went on the attack around it. She and folks who support her in the media really spread a lot of misinformation about astronomical costs that are completely false. And so now she's kind of put herself in a corner on this issue where it's easy to explain away the misinformation, but unfortunately she also was the deliverer, and her surrogates were the deliverer of that misinformation. So she'd have to explain away why she was spreading that misinformation. It's easy to explain, you know, the misinformation around costs and things like that, because every study that's ever been done shows that Medicare for All would save money. It would save lives. It would cover everybody. So that the facts are actually can't be disputed, even though they tried to in the primary. But there's actually no study that can back them up. But unfortunately, politics and facts don't always align.
That was Pilar Schiavo, an organizer with the National Nurses United Union. Find more information on the campaign to establish a universal single-payer health care system in the U.S. by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
On February 26th, the Federal Communications Commission voted in favor of new regulations that reclassified broadband internet as a public utility under Title II of the Communications Act. The new rules prohibit internet service providers, including cellular carriers, from blocking, slowing down, or speeding up online traffic or giving priority to web services in exchange for payment. But the U.S. Telecom Association, an industry group representing providers including Comcast, Verizon, and AT&T, launched a legal challenge to scrap the FCC net neutrality rules, arguing that the new regulations threaten innovation and undermine investment in broadband infrastructure. A central issue was whether or not the FCC had the authority to reclassify internet providers as utilities after a previous attempt to mandate net neutrality rules was struck down by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit in 2014. However, on June 14th, that same court rejected the industry challenge and upheld the FCC's net neutrality rules, stating that the commission exercised its proper authority when it reclassified broadband internet access as a telecom service under Title II of the Communications Act. Your reporter spoke with Craig Aaron, president and CEO of the media democracy group Free Press, one of the nation's leading net neutrality advocacy organizations. Here he reviews the recent court decision and his group's hard-fought victory, as well as the ongoing fight for a universal, affordable, and open internet.
Net neutrality really is just a way of saying no discrimination. And it means when you go online, you can go wherever you want, do whatever you want, download whatever you want. It's not up to your phone or cable company to decide which websites are going to work and which won't. And for nearly a decade now, we've been fighting in Washington to protect net neutrality. And through some previously, I think, unfortunate court decisions and a lot of unwillingness in the past of the Federal Communications Commission to act, net neutrality was really in jeopardy. We were facing a future of the internet that, you know, doesn't look like the free and open internet we've enjoyed, but looks a lot more like cable television. But we saw a big reversal thanks to really an unprecedented amount of public pressure, millions and millions of people contacting the Federal Communications Commission throughout 2014 and 2015, finally getting the FCC, which had attempted time and again to pass really watered-down net neutrality rules, finally getting them to stand up, do strong net neutrality rules, really restore their authority under the Communications Act, authority that had been sort of abdicated during the Bush administration, restore it, make sure they can make strong rules and step in if phone or cable companies are messing with people's internet experience. And this has been a long fight, but a good one in a lot of ways, because it really shows when you don't accept those compromises, when you don't go back into court with sort of half measures, you actually can win. And that's what happened here. The FCC finally did the right thing, went in with their strongest legal case, and they were awarded for doing so. The judges at the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals on a 2-1 decision ruled completely for the FCC. They won on every issue in the case, and this was really a resounding defeat for the phone and cable lobby and for their very expensive lawyers that they sent in to try to overturn those FCC rules.
Craig, I wanted to just explore with you in the couple of minutes we have remaining about future challenges, because certainly the fight for unfettered communication in our country and new technologies and ensuring there is an even playing field so we can utilize these new technologies on an equal basis, that fight is far from over. And I know your group is continuing to push in many different directions, FCC enforcement of the rules now on the books and upheld by this court, as well as access. Access to the internet is huge, and I know that's something on your agenda.
In terms of the FCC taking action, you know, certainly we want to make sure that now that they won this case, now that they have this authority, that they're going to be willing to step in and use it if there are, you know, violations. That's sometimes been a problem at the FCC in the past, an actual willingness to take action. So we'll definitely, as we see violations emerge, you know, definitely be stepping in to sound the alarm. Probably the most immediate concern is actually Congress. You know, there's a suite of bills. I think I counted
six different measures, these riders that are trying to be snuck into must-pass budget bills as we speak this week in Washington, trying to really attack both of these issues, trying to prevent the FCC taking away their budget to enforce these rules. There are attempts to undo some very common sense reforms on issues like set-top boxes that they want to put forward. There's an attack on the Lifeline program, which the FCC is trying to extend to broadband, which is an essential program for connecting poor folks to phones. Now an opportunity to extend that to broadband, but the Republicans in Congress are moving to stop that. So there's a lot of work still to be done to get these riders out of the budget bill, to make sure that all of Congress and the president are aware of they're in there, so they can be cut out of these bills if they're negotiated and they go through the Senate. We've been successful in doing that a number of times, but they do keep coming. So the fights will continue to come. These companies haven't given up, unfortunately. You know, they may try to appeal to the Supreme Court. I think they have a very weak case, but they have a limitless budget. So they'll continue to try to make it difficult for the FCC. We've come a long, long way in actually getting an agency to do the right thing for once. Now we have to protect that and make sure they actually use the power that they have when we need it. We have a real competition problem in this country, and that's proving to be an incredible barrier for people getting online. So I think this is going to be one of the big priorities. We're really pushing the presidential candidates and the political parties to address this crisis of affordability, to prioritize Internet access for all. We just put together a whole big platform that includes a number of issues, but access is one of the pillars. Internet policy platform for 2016, which about 18 different public interest groups signed.
That was Craig Aaron, president and CEO of the media democracy group FreePress.net. Find more information on groups working to preserve and expand Internet freedom by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
The Trump triumph. Several months ago, I mentioned that the Republican Party has been morphed into the Trump Party. That transformation is now complete. Forces that stood against him have been silenced, shouted down, intimidated, or purged. When his last challenger, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, dared to suggest Republican voters should vote their conscience, yells of endorse Trump were followed by a chorus of boos when he failed to do so. He and his wife were threatened by Trump conventioneers. Republicans were rushed to the exits by angry Trumpists. The Republican National Convention was not a presidential event, but a celebration of ego, anger, and gross wealth. It is the party of Trump. The very fact that he has done so is nothing short of remarkable. Trump is, to be honest, a fair-weather Republican. His victory over the party is the political equivalent to a hostile takeover in business. You buy a majority of shares, control the board of directors, and fire those you don't want or don't need. You loot the company and leave it a bankrupt shell. The Republican Party has become a shell of its former self. It is hollow, an echo chamber of seething hatreds, mass ego, revenge fantasies, and white nationalism. It is the party of Goldwater, the party of Nixon, the party of Agnew, the party of thin-lipped anger at the change that has swept the nation since the 1960s. The convention, if it showed anything, was the thin veneer of hatred and unity in contempt against Hillary Clinton. It is united against anyone perceived as the other. It is united in fear and dread. It is against everything. It is for nothing but Donald J. Trump. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Unprovoked killings by cops in the streets of America's Midwest and the subsequent killings of cops in Texas show us that a new stage has been reached in America's longest internal war and that no one knows how it will end. The problem of police violence, of course, isn't new. When Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. led anti-segregation protests in Selma, Alabama, in the 1960s, cops didn't assist protesters. They beat them savagely for violating the unjust laws of white supremacy. They beat men and women indiscriminately to protect white privilege. The Edmund Pettus Bridge became slick with black blood. Today, they kill with utter impunity black men, women, and children like Mike Brown, Rakia Boyd, Tamir Rice, Eric Gardner. And nothing happens. Secret grand juries and not-so-secret judges repeatedly rule justified homicide, and killer cops get promotions. Good job, and nothing. Today, media, politicians, and police call Micah Xavier Johnson a madman, deranged, according to one prominent politician. But if he is mad, what made him so? Was he mad when he went to kill Afghanistanis on behalf of the empire? Perhaps they trained him too well. Oppression maddens people. It drives them mad. It turns calm brains into mad minds, consumed with anger, rage, and resentments. The media, ministers, and politicians will call him names, but he is beyond your curses now. His life was a curse already. To be born a nigger in America, that's curse enough. In 1951, the great poet Langston Hughes, in his poem Harlem, wrote, "What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun? Or fester like a sore and then run? Does it stink like rotten meat? Or crust and sugar over like a syrupy sweet? Maybe it just sags like a heavy load. Or does it explode?" From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Has prevailed on his action to bar the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections from ever holding him in isolation again. In a remarkable settlement bringing an end to Schultz v. Wetzel, Maroon won on all counts. The only thing lacking is a judge's written opinion. Upon learning of the settlement, Maroon stated, "I have nothing but praise for all of those who supported me and my family for all the years I was in solitary confinement, as well as helped to effect my release. Since joining the struggle for human rights in the mid-1960s, I have always chosen to fight. Frederick Douglass was right when he said, power concedes nothing without a demand. So have no doubt that I see this settlement as anything but the latest blow struck, and you rest assured that I will continue in the struggle for human rights. Straight ahead, Russell Maroon Schultz." Under the terms of the settlement, the DOC has agreed to not place Maroon in solitary over his prior disciplinary record. He is to be single-celled for life, and Maroon was granted a monetary settlement. Maroon was held in solitary confinement from 1983 to 2014. With the exception of 19 months he spent in federal custody at Leavenworth, where he lived in general population. So for 22 consecutive years, a lifetime, Russell Maroon Schultz has been held by the state of Pennsylvania in isolation, conditions described as torture by the United Nations Special Rapporteur Juan Mendez, who called for Maroon's release from solitary. Mendez served as a defense expert for Schultz. Russell Maroon Schultz was represented in this federal civil rights action by Brett Groeve and Dustin McDaniel, Esquires of the Abolitionist Law Center of Pittsburgh, Harold J. Engel, Esquire, and attorneys Rick Etter and Stephanie L. Burt of the law firm Reed Smith. The struggle continues, and sometimes you win. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Following is a repeat broadcast of the Global Research News Hour, which originally aired December 4th, 2015. What is behind the rash of police violence against African Americans? How is it that police killings like those of Michael Brown or of Laquan McDonald can be conducted with almost complete impunity for the offenders? Are there substantive links between police brutality in Minneapolis and the flourishing of white supremacist groups there? In what ways have the freedom struggles of the 60s and 70s been successful, and where have there been failures? What are the historic roots of the problem of racist violence against Black Americans, and where do solutions lie? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we examine the phenomenon of racialized policing in Minneapolis and throughout the United States, as well as the recent explosion of anti-racism activism conceived to confront that violence. Our guests for the hour include Michelle Gross, activist with a Minneapolis-based police watchdog group, and commentator Abayomi Azikiwe, the editor of Pan-African Newswire. On this week's show, Black Lives Matter, investigating the culture of impunity of racist police violence in the United States. Bringing you the analysis beyond the headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of December 4th, 2015. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Illegal oil revenues are one of the main sources of income for the terrorists in Syria. According to some reports, they make about $2 billion a year on illegal oil trade. Turkey is the main destination for the oil stolen from its legitimate owners, which are Syria and Iraq. Turkey resells this oil. The appalling part about it is that the country's top political leadership is involved in the illegal business. President Erdogan and his family. That was from a speech given by Russian Deputy Defense Minister Anatoly Antonov during a December 2nd briefing. Transcribed in the article, Bombshell, Russian Military Reveals Details of ISIS-Daesh Funding, Turkey's Role in Supporting the Terrorists, Complete Transcript, Videos, Documents, by Syrian Free Press, posted December 3rd. A statistical analysis performed by George Kyorksoglu, visiting lecturer, University of Greenwich, London, and Dr. Alec D. Kutrubis, principal lecturer, University of Greenwich, London, determined that, quote, "It seems that whenever the Islamic State is fighting in the vicinity of an area hosting oil assets, the 13 exports from the Turkish state-owned oil refinery at Ceyhan promptly spike. This may be attributed to an extra boost given to crude oil smuggling with the aim of immediately generating additional funds badly needed for the supply of ammunition and military equipment," unquote. And Zero Hedge has rounded up a variety of circumstantial evidence indicating that the Turkish leaders are intentionally smuggling ISIS oil into Turkey and then out to the Mediterranean using the same supply routes used to smuggle illegal Kurdish oil. Will the Turkish president keep his word and resign? That comes from the article, "Yes, Turkey is buying oil from ISIS," by Washington's blog, posted December 2nd. As Mahdi Hassan points out in The New Statesman, quote, "If bombing worked, Iraq would have morphed into a Scandinavia-style utopia long ago," unquote. Instead, the country is in chaos, breaking records for terrorist activity while ever more foreign fighters flood into the country day by day. In other cases, like Syria, the connection is less clear. What is accepted, even by American intelligence agencies, is that after the deaths of hundreds of civilians and thousands of fighters from coalition bombs, Daesh, or ISIS, is certainly no weaker now than it was a year ago. In fact, its fighter ranks may have swelled from 20,000 to 31,500 to at least 80,000 in the past year. That comes from the article, "The Entire War on Terror Has Been a Lie, and These Charts Prove It," by Rebecca Sumner, posted December 2nd, originally appearing at The Canary. In September 2014, a photo of Netanyahu and Ya'alon visiting terrorists receiving care in an Israeli hospital went viral online. Netanyahu seen shaking a terrorist's hand. According to the Al Arabi Al Jadid newspaper, quote, "Israel has in one way or another become the main marketer of ISIS oil. Without them, most ISIS-produced oil would have remained going between Iraq, Syria, and Turkey. Even the three companies would not receive the oil if they did not have a buyer in Israel," unquote. In October, Iraqi security forces captured an Israeli colonel, Yuri Ulen Shahak, working directly with ISIS terrorists. That comes from the article, "Israel Supports ISIS," by Stephen Lendman, posted December 2nd. The problem that Turkey faces now is that the Russian-led coalition is rapidly destroying the infrastructure that provides funding for ISIS, oil refineries, fields, and transport, while gradually retaking territory that was formerly controlled by the many anti-regime or al-Qaeda-linked groups in the north, west, and central parts of the country. In the last few days alone, Russia and company have concluded the encirclement of Syria's biggest city, Aleppo, vaporized a convoy of over 500 oil trucks in the vicinity of Raqqa, and intensified their bombing in the Turkmen Mountains, the Kurdish Mountains, and the Prophet Jonah Mountains. The coalition has moved as far north as Azaz along the Turkish border and recaptured the strategic Aleppo-Raqqa highway, which completely cuts off ISIS supply route from the east in Raqqa. All of the recent progress comes in the wake of the retaking of the strategic Kuwaris airbase, which was the tipping point in the 4.5-year-long conflict. Now the Russian coalition has focused on closing the border, a move that will sever vital supply lines to pro-Turkish militias operating in Syria and force the terrorists to either flee or surrender. That comes from the article, "Putin's Revenge, The Fight for the Border," by Mike Whitney, posted December 2nd, originally appearing at Counterpunch. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Black Lives Matter was spawned in 2013 as a social media hashtag following the acquittal of George Zimmerman in the shooting death of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. The movement continued to gather momentum in 2014 following the deaths of 18-year-old African-American Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, and of Eric Garner, a Staten Island, New York native, both at the hands of police officers. While this anti-racism activism may not have resulted in justice for the multitude of slain African Americans gunned down with impunity by police officials and vigilantes like Zimmerman, the movement at least seems to have raised awareness among citizens inside and outside America of the depth of the problem of racialized justice in the states. Minneapolis, Minnesota may serve as an important case study of this phenomenon. On November 15th, Jamar Clark was fatally shot by police. Multiple witnesses reported Jamar was shot while handcuffed. Anti-racism activists had set up a protest encampment outside the 4th Precinct, demanding the release of the video footage of the killing of the 24-year-old Clark. On Monday, November 23rd, alleged white supremacists fired at unarmed protesters, wounding 5. As this program is being put together on Thursday, December 3rd, the encampment has been taken down by police using bulldozers, and 8 of the protesters have been arrested. 200 Black Lives Matter protesters have taken their demonstration to Minneapolis City Hall. The Global Research NewsHour recently caught up with a longtime activist involved in campaigns to confront police brutality in the Minnesota metropolis. We approached her to get some explanation of the context of police violence being conducted against African Americans and other persons of color in her city. I'm joined right now by Michelle Gross. She is with a group called Communities United Against Police Brutality, a Minneapolis-based police watchdog group. Thank you very much for joining us, Michelle.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so first of all, could you just give us a little bit of background on Communities United Against Police Brutality, how it came together and how it functions?
Sure. We have been together, working together for 15 years. Our organization came together because there had been organizing around police brutality every year in the Twin Cities. There's an annual National Day of Protest Against Police Brutality on October 22nd, and we had been organizing for some years. Around that, one of the people who spoke at the event, a man named Abuka Sanders, who is well known in the community because he was involved in the spoken word movement. And he was well known. He spoke at our event, and then 8 days later, on November 1st of 2000, he was driving home from working overnight as a personal care attendant for a terminally ill man. He was tired. He was driving the car home so his wife could take the kids to school. And the cops said he was driving erratically. They boxed him in, and they gunned him down. 37 shots. This man was unarmed. And, of course, the community was very inflamed. So we started, you know, doing the Justice for Abuka Sanders thing. We were having protests and sit-ins at City Hall and all of that. And along the way, it occurred to me that the way we were doing this work, by waiting for something bad to happen and then reacting to it, was all wrong. We needed to be much more proactive in terms of, you know, not having to recreate a movement every time something happened, but also in dealing with the day-to-day abuses that lead to the conditions that allowed those bigger incidents to occur. So that's kind of the forming basis of Communities United Against Police Brutality. We're an all-volunteer group, but we've been doing this successfully for 15 years.
Mm-hmm. Now, my understanding is that Minneapolis, or in Minnesota, has the highest or among the highest rates of over-prosecution of blacks in the entire nation. Do you have any insights into what's anything unique about your neck of the woods?
Yes, and you're absolutely correct. We do have the highest rate. We're the state with the highest rate of over-prosecution of blacks in the entire country. And our jails are by far the blackest place in our state, and more than that, the you know, what's happened here, what's led to this situation is, you know, a lot of people here want to pretend that this place is very liberal and very nice and all of this kind of stuff. But the reality is that this is a very, very racist state. It has racist institutions. This was the state that also historically had the largest massacre of American Indians in the entire country, you know, historically. So we have a long history of, you know, of slaughters of people of color here and you know, detrimental actions toward people of color that ruin people's lives. You know, here, like I said, our jails are just, and prisons are just littered with people who, you know, mostly drug war victims and things like that. And so, you know, we've got a huge problem. A big part of that is that this is a very white state. Statewide, African Americans only make up 3% of the population. Now, in the Twin Cities, African Americans make up 14% of the population. So it's, you know, but it's still a, you know, a small segment of people that experience the, you know, the wrath of the whites, if you will, you know, how you want to put it. But they, you know, they really are victimized by these, just these institutions and systems that perpetuate racism.
And I understand the city of Minneapolis has paid millions upon millions of dollars settling cases of police brutality over the last decade and a half.
Oh, yes. Every year, our city, we have 850 officers, sworn officers, and every year our city pays out at least $3,000 in judgments and settlements per officer, you know, which means, and it's not all the officers that are doing it, so it means there's a segment, we figure it's in the neighborhood of about 150 to 200 officers that are the most problematic and that cost the city the most money. But yet, even though the city is happy to pay out these settlements and judgments, they are not at all willing to hold these police officers accountable. You know, there's no consequences for the cops for doing this stuff, and that's why it goes on.
Mm-hmm. And so the courts, they're not holding the police agencies accountable, and that points to the idea of judicial impropriety. Has there been complaints leveled against the Judicial Standards Board or some other oversight body?
There is no point in this system anywhere in which police will be held accountable. We'll start with the city itself. We used to have a civilian review authority, and they were not very effective because they weren't given the power or the finances, you know, the resources to do their job. But at least they did sustain some cases. They were never disciplined, but they were sustained. And then, you know, that was at least something. We have been placed now in the last 3 years. The city got rid of that, put into place a thing called the Office of Police Conduct Review. In 3 years, they have heard well over 1,000 cases. Not one single case by a community member has been sustained and disciplined. Not one in 3 years. Now, I'm sorry, you can't tell me that over 1,000 people are liars. That's just wrong. You know, so that starts the problem. Then, when people are brutalized by police, they're inevitably arrested and charged falsely with obstructing legal process, disorderly conduct, you know, fifth degree assault on an officer, which is like you could breathe in the guy's face and get that charge, you know. Just, you know, anything like that. They put these phony charges on people to attempt to justify their brutality. And what they know in the United States is that we have a U.S. Supreme Court decision called Heck versus Humphrey. If you go down on criminal charges in the incident, you have no lawsuit. So this is an attempt to basically prevent a lawsuit. And so people end up, you know, going down on criminal charges, or they make a deal or something like that, and then their lawsuit flies out the window. So this is their whole risk management strategy. The bottom line is that it's a misuse of the criminal justice system to try to cover for the officers. The judges are more than willing to go along with it because they believe anything that comes out of a cop's mouth, like it's the Bible or something, and they don't believe things that come from the community, even though they hear them over and over again. And so the judges are biased, very biased, and it just goes on from there. The post board, we have a thing called the post board here, which is the Peace Officer Standard and Training Board. It's the licensing agency of the police. You can file complaints with them, but they fall into a black hole. They go nowhere. We filed 31 complaints with them about grotesque corruption, massive theft by their licensees. There was a whole thing called the Metro Gang Strike Force. It was already exposed, and like in a report that was done by the state attorney general thing. You know, this thing where there was proof that they stole people's cars, they stole money, they brutalized people, they stole their property, and these people had committed no crimes whatsoever. This was a massive criminal enterprise by the police. We filed 31 complaints, you know, on behalf of 31 victims, and the Post Board did nothing with them. You know, these people engaged in felony conduct, and the Post Board did nothing against their licenses. So every point in the state where you go to try to get some, you know, accountability for this conduct, at every point the system deliberately puts up roadblocks and deliberately fails to hold police accountable. The situation that happened with Jamar Clark was pretty much inevitable because the system has never held police accountable in this community. And now they're about to try to let these cops walk. I don't know if your listeners know that. They have now announced that they're going to put this in front of a grand jury. And grand jury, when you say I'm going to put it in front of a grand jury, that's code language for we're going to use the grand jury to give ourselves political cover for not bringing charges against these cops. In 150 years, not one single police officer in the state of Minnesota has been indicted by a grand jury for harming a member of the community.
Mm. That's very interesting. I just wanted to like follow up on your previous comments. You're talking about the roadblocks. I'm wondering if it goes beyond that. I mean, like retaliation against complainants like yourself. Is there any examples you might want to evoke?
Many. While we were in the middle of pursuing our complaints about the Metro Gang Strike Force, you know, this criminal enterprise, one of the individuals who was one of our complainants suddenly found himself being, you know, followed and the cops showing up at his house all the time. We've had many acts of retaliation. We worked with a case where people, you know, had gotten brutalized the night before on a Sunday night. They went down to City Hall the next morning thinking that they could walk into Internal Affairs and make their complaint. They didn't know that you shouldn't do that because it's a bad idea and that there's retaliation. As they were driving home, the same officers who brutalized them the day before followed them home and brutalized them again. Yeah, there's many incidents like that.
My goodness. And what about white supremacist organizations? Do you see them flourishing in Minneapolis?
They're the kind of ugly underbelly that a lot of people don't want to acknowledge here. Back in 2001, I was part of an organizing that we called Can the Klan, Can like put them in a garbage can. And we, the Klan, the National Socialist Movement, and all three branches, the skinheads, all three branches of the white supremacy kind of movement in the U.S., came together in the Twin Cities to attempt to have a rally and to do some recruiting in Minnesota. But their plan was essentially to go to, all the whitest states in the U.S. and try to form a stronghold. And we had an extremely effective event. Over 4,500 people came out to oppose these people. But they still have had gotten some legs under them here. And these guys, four of them actually plotted and planned and attacked the encampment that people had formed outside the 4th Precinct. So they attacked this encampment. They shot activists. They shot people. You know, five different people were shot. They literally just strafed the crowd with bullets. It is lucky that no one was killed. It is lucky that more people were not injured. And yet, you know, we have these big, you know, mass shootings that happen at, like, movie theaters and everything, and everybody gets up in arms about that. But people seem to be fine with people gunning down people at a protest. And, you know, it's really quite outrageous. It's one of the most, you know, most egregious things because we're talking about gunning people down for exercising their First Amendment rights. And yet, you know, the cops have not taken it seriously. The charges they leveled against these avowed white supremacists who actually, plotted this and openly plotted what they were going to do. I mean, we have emails showing where they were talking about who's going to wear what and which guns to bring and all this stuff. So it was planned in advance. That's first degree premeditated murder attempt. And yet these guys have gotten really low-level charges put on them. It's so outrageous. And they're saying, oh, we can't charge them with hate crimes because we can't show it. Well, why can't you show it? I've got the emails. How come you don't? You know, I'm trying to put these in the hands of law enforcement, and they're not interested in getting them. So it's just such nonsense. It is so clear that white supremacy is just down to the core of the institutions in this area.
Yes, you've outlined some outrageous dynamics, and you talked about a grand jury coming down, and it's fairly well understood that this is kind of like a kind of a cover-up type situation where nothing is actually going to get done. How do you see the community reacting to this? Is it going to be more of the same? Is there anything you can disclose about where things go from here?
There's a lot of actions being taken and going to be taken to apply pressure to the county attorney to force him to not use a grand jury. You know, I don't know if that's going to be successful or not. I think we need to do that. It must happen. There's also a separate investigation that's happening by the FBI, but we aren't really convinced that that's going to be all that valuable because they're doing all the interviewing of the witnesses in tandem and meaning that they're going to get, you know, we don't think that they're really doing a good job. The main agency that's doing the investigation for the state is called the BCA. Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, which is like the state version of the FBI.
Could you repeat that? I don't think we quite caught it.
It's called the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and it's about the same as – it's like a state version of the FBI. But most people here call it Bureau of Cop Assistance because, you know, basically they're going to want – they never hold police accountable. They have screwed the community over and over. No one trusts them. No one believes that they're going to do a good job. And people are starting to have big doubts about whether the FBI is going to do a good job. There's a lot of concerns about that. So, you know, we don't think it's going to be a real great investigation. And even if they were trying legitimately to do a good investigation, the investigation has already been tainted from the start because in the immediate aftermath of this event, 30 to 40 squad cars descended on the neighborhood. This is a small community. 30 to 40 squad cars, almost all white cops came barreling out of the cars, pointing guns at people's faces, pointing tasers at people, pepper spraying people, basically, and stealing people's cell phones. So, you know, witnesses are deathly afraid to come forward. You know, I don't even know who all has shown up at these for witness statements because I've talked to several people, two people in two completely separate circumstances told me the identical story that a cop ran up to them, snatched their cell phone out of their face, out of their hands, put a gun to their head and said, "You better not tell what you saw here or you're going to end up like that kid over there," referring to Jamar Clark. So, you know, we know that there's been an enormous amount of witness intimidation in this case. And so that has tainted the investigation from the very beginning.
Hmm. You tend to think if organized crime was running the city of Minneapolis, would you notice a difference?
Really, you know, they might gun down less black folks, you know, honestly.
Okay. We're almost at the end of our time. Are there any other details or facts of significance you would like to leave with our listeners?
Well, again, you know, this is a systematic problem. You know, many people always want to talk about, well, there's bad cops and there's good cops. I always think it's important to point out it's not about bad cops or good cops, but it's about a bad system. And it's a system that refuses to hold police accountable. And when you have a system like that, it's a toxic mix because it ends up causing people to causing police to feel like they have impunity to do this. So no, it's not every officer doing this. It feels like it's close to the Wild West, but it may not be. But the bottom line is that we have a system that is so completely and utterly dysfunctional, and not just dysfunctional, but willfully dysfunctional, and not holding police accountable, which means that what you have is state-sanctioned violence. And that's, you know, the reason why we are working so hard to get at these underlying causes of this problem. There are some solutions. We are working hard on those solutions. One of the main ones we're working on is requiring police officers to carry their own professional liability insurance so that they would have a personal consequence if they engage in this conduct. You know, if they cause their insurance company to pay out more money, their premiums are going to go up, or they might become uninsurable and we can get rid of these guys. So there are solutions that we're working on. This is a very intractable problem. It's a hard problem, but we, like I said, we are working on solutions. And people, you know, I hope people will get involved, and wherever you live, get involved. You know, your listeners can look up more information at www.cuapb.org.
Michelle Gross, thank you very much for sharing those insights with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Michelle Gross is an organizer with the Communities United Against Police Brutality, a Minneapolis-based police watchdog group.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. We'll air an interview with prominent African-American essayist and commentator Abayomi Azikiwe in just moments. But first, we'll play a song. Here's legendary recording artist Gil Scott-Heron with the song "The Revolution Will Not Be Televised" from the 1971 album Pieces of a Man. Stay tuned.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nub. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on report from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still life of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he has been saving for just the proper occasion. Green Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so damn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally got down with Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of Harry R. Woman Liberationist and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Key, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, Engelbert Humperdinck, or The Rare Earth. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with Coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.
A string of racially charged incidents involving police brutality and impunity for law officials has galvanized Americans by the tens of thousands to stage demonstrations and civil disobedience actions across the U.S. The hashtag Black Lives Matter has come into prominence and is waking up all races within and outside the continental United States to the ongoing reality of racial disharmony and social inequality in what's called the land of the free and the home of the brave. Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Tamir Rice, Jamar Clark, just a few names on the roster of those killed in cold blood with no acceptable punitive actions taken against the offenders. Add to this the high incarceration rate of men of color, and it becomes clear that there are systemic problems affecting race that need to be addressed and confronted. to help contextualize the epidemic of police and legal violence against the people of color, we're joined by Abayomi Azikiwe. He is the editor of Pan-African Newswire, an outspoken and frequent commentator on issues of African and world affairs. Many of his essays are published at the Global Research website. It's good to have you with us, Abayomi Azikiwe.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so I was wondering, first of all, what are we to make of this phenomenon? Are we talking about, just something about our law enforcement system that attracts racists, or is there some sort of like a conscious conspiracy to subdue and criminalize people of color from the beat level on up to state agencies like the FBI? What is your take on that?
It's a combination of both. You have a system that was born in racism, in genocide, in forced removal. And therefore, in order to maintain that system, a state apparatus was put into place in order to oppress as well as contain those who were the center of this form of exploitation. If you look at the forced removal of the native people of the United States, it was done over a period of approximately two centuries in a very brutal and a very dismissive fashion. The importation of millions of people of African descent who were brought into the United States as slaves from 1619 all the way up to the illegal abolition of slavery in 1865. The entire political economy of the United States was based on forced removal, enslavement, and super exploitation. We look during the so-called antebellum period. That's the period after the independence of the U.S. From Britain up until the Civil War. The major engine of the economy was the production of agricultural goods and later on, particularly cotton. And as a result of the production and exploitation of cotton, that slavery flourished inside the United States, particularly in the South, but it had also been very widespread on the East Coast as well as other parts of the country, even in the Midwest. I believe that this factor plays into how African people, African Americans, are perceived by the ruling interests inside the United States. Even after the conclusion of the Civil War, the failure of Reconstruction, which lasted at least on a federal level for approximately 12 years, and then on a state level, it was able to survive up until the turn of the 19th and 20th centuries, you still had institutionalized racism. There was lynchings. There was close collaboration between groups such as the Ku Klux Klan and local law enforcement agencies. You had courts and you had laws that specifically were designed for the repression of African Americans. Even today, some 50 years after the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, there is massive discrimination and oppression against African Americans. It has come to the light very starkly in the last 3 years with such high-profile cases as the vigilante killing of Trayvon Martin. There was the police killing of Michael Brown in 2014. Also, the killing of Eric Garner. And the most recent upheavals centered around the shooting of Jamar Clark in Minneapolis and the release of a video of the killing of McDonald, Laquan McDonald in Chicago, 17-year-old African-American youth that was shot 16 times as he was walking away from the police. So these are how these reasons are connected to the history of the development of the United States all the way up until the present, where, of course, we have the police who are reinforcing this same system of national oppression and super exploitation.
Now, the extent to which these killings have become national news Is that a reflection of some kind of a resurgence, or it's been going on all the time? It's only now that the cameras are out and it's getting as much attention as it's getting. What is your sense of that?
Well, the FBI does not necessarily keep records of the police killings of particularly African Americans in any type of systematic and efficient way. You've had publications that have done studies, leading U.S. publications that reveal that thousands upon people have been killed over the last two decades by the police, not only African Americans, but people from other national minorities as well as whites. I think now there is a system that is developing among community organizations, non-governmental organizations, certain periodicals and journals that are doing a better job at documenting the frequency and the severity of these killings. Also, the advent of social media, the internet as well, allows people to communicate even in a media framework with millions and even billions of people instantaneously. So there's a greater awareness. There's a much better form of communication between activists, those in the communities, and also communications outwardly towards the national and international community. Now, what we've seen in the last 3 years, it appears it is a rash of intolerance and brutal and deadly force being exercised by the police. This is happening from rural areas all the way to small towns and suburbs such as Ferguson, Missouri, which only had 21,000 people living in it, to Baltimore, which is a major municipality in the southeast, to Minneapolis, where over the last two decades, a lot of African Americans have migrated there from Chicago and other cities in the Midwest due to the shifting economic character of the United States. I believe that there is a greater awareness, a greater sensitivity, and we've seen the struggle against police brutality and police killings, in a sense, merging with a new movement coming off of the campuses, starting at some of the most elite universities in the United States, the University of Missouri, Columbia, Princeton, Georgetown, Brown University, which have had demonstrations led by African-American students against institutional racism, against symbols of racism. For example, at Princeton, demanding the closing of the Woodrow Wilson Center. And there's been numerous demonstrations all across the United States targeting buildings that are named after former slave owners. Presidents such as Woodrow Wilson, who were ideological racists. I believe that this level of sensitivity and activism and organization and mobilization is going to continue because the federal government, along with the corporate community, really has no program to address these issues. If we look at the actual economic status of African Americans, they lost tremendously during the Great Recession beginning in 2007, 2008, and actually the losses began much earlier than that because of the so-called dot-com boom collapse of the early 2000s. During the Great Recession, African communities lost their homes to the hundreds of thousands in states like Michigan and other areas throughout the United States. And they have not recovered from that. You have an unemployment rate in the United States where African Americans have twice the rate of joblessness than the national average. You have to look at the level of social wealth, household wealth, accumulated household debt. All of these factors are contributing to this degree of intolerance and also anger that is rising among African Americans. Mm.
So then do you see a correlation then between economic hardship and economic inequality and these gestures of police and judicial violence?
Yes, because the focus from a public policy level has been on the elimination of crime in major urban areas and also in suburbs and even in rural areas. And African Americans are identified as being disproportionately involved in criminal activity. They are targeted specifically for that purpose, and as a result of that, they are overrepresented in the prison industrial complex. So you have, from a proportional standpoint, far more African Americans incarcerated in the United States than you do whites. That doesn't mean that more African Americans use illegal drugs. They commit crimes, but they are treated differently by the courts. They are racially profiled. For example, the federal government did a study of Ferguson and St. Louis County last year, which they released. It was entitled the Ferguson Report, and it indicated that local municipalities in St. Louis County were deliberately targeting African-American motorists for being stopped, for being issued three, sometimes four citations per stop. And as a result of that, you had approximately 12,000 outstanding warrants against mainly African-Americans in a city of 21,000 people. So that was an average, it was calculated by the New York Times, of two outstanding warrants, a lot of which are derived from traffic citations per household in Ferguson, Missouri. I mean, it was a huge aspect of the federal government's report on Ferguson. And despite all of this, the government said that there was still not enough probable cause for the police and the local municipal officials to be prosecuted under federal law. Now, they did apparently make some arrangements for these people, higher-ranking officials, the police chiefs, some people involved in the courts, that they would resign in exchange for not being prosecuted. However, this phenomena is not just centered in Ferguson, Missouri. This is a pattern that can be replicated all across the United States.
I was wondering if we could go back to the movements of the 50 years ago, the 60s. You had the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee right up through the rise of the Black Panthers with these same issues out in the open. And I'm wondering if you'd be willing to maybe briefly assess what have been the successes and the failures of those movements of 5 decades ago in confronting institutional racism in America.
The success centered around the passage of legislation, as I alluded to earlier, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965. But what is often not known by many people is that there was an attempt to pass a civil rights bill in 1966 that would have guaranteed fair housing and an elimination of housing discrimination and other issues in the United States. Well, what was happening in 1966? This was after the Watts Rebellion of 1965. During 1966, there was urban rebellions in dozens of cities across the country. The slogan Black Power became extremely popular inside the United States. It contended with the more what was considered mainstream or moderate slogans and demands as advocated by the Southern Christian Leadership Conference under Dr. Martin Luther King. These developments pushed King further to the left. So by 1966, he was calling for much more stringent measures on the part of the government. Now, mind you, this was after the passage of these two major civil rights bills the two preceding years. In 67, there were even more urban rebellions. They reached their highest level with over 164 urban rebellions, according to the National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorder that was impaneled after the Detroit Rebellion of 1967. And, of course, King came out solidly against the war in Vietnam. He linked the war in Vietnam to the failure of the United States to address its own internal problems, to eliminate poverty, to thoroughly eliminate institutionalized racism. He also looked at U.S. foreign policy and essentially declared it as being imperialistic. He was killed in 1968 while he was in Memphis working with sanitation employees who were seeking recognition as a trade union. So we can see that King himself was moving more to the left. He never abandoned nonviolence per se, but who knows, if he had have lived, he may have become more aligned with Black Power and some of the revolutionary movements that were evolving at the time. The Black Panther Party, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the Republic of New Africa, the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, all of these organizations saw the need for a fundamental transformation of U.S. society. That movement was attacked as well by the federal government through the counterintelligence program, which influenced local police agencies to target their activists and organizations, round them up, put them under false charges, utilize the media to denigrate their efforts. And of course, this had a tremendous blow against the movement overall. And then at the same time, there was an opening up of the political structures inside the United States. So they utilized the notion of the ability to integrate within U.S. society through running for public office, opening up new job categories to African Americans. Those who weren't willing to accept that could face either death by the police, framing by law enforcement agencies and the courts, or many, of course, being driven into exile as well. These are multifaceted methods that have been used over the last five decades to contain and also suppress the African-American people, not to mention the rapid increase in the prison industrial complex, the 500% increase in the number of people who are incarcerated in the United States over the last 3.5 decades. These are serious issues, and they are not given attention even by the White House that is now run by a person who is of African descent. There's been no major public policy initiatives launched by the Obama administration to do anything to correct the structural unemployment among African Americans, the high rate of incarceration, the level of militarization of the police, and also the fight to stop this type of racial profiling and victimization by law enforcement.
So that brings us up to the movement of today with Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter. How would you assess it? Is that do you see it as enduring, as being resilient, or is there some signs already of it being I don't know, contained or co-opted or otherwise thwarted?
It's not a uniform movement. There have been efforts to turn it into a more systematic and organized force, but it's really not possible at this time because it just evolved 3 years ago. But it's part of a broader struggle, a struggle to bring about the realization of the unfinished quest for civil rights, human rights, national liberation, economic equality. You have different political tendencies within the anti-racist movement in the United States at this time. So it's going to have to play itself out in the streets, on the campuses, and in the workplaces. And we see that taking place in a myriad of fashions right now. So we're looking forward to how the movement is going to take on these monumental issues. For example, last year, people started to march into shopping malls, particularly during the holiday seasons, which is a very, very important time period for the capitalist system here in the United States. We saw an escalation of that last weekend during Black Friday, where in Chicago they were able to shut down for several hours the so-called Magnificent Mile retail district. Thousands, largely African Americans, but others, were able to block store entrances. And this, of course, had a tremendous impact on the politics in Chicago and also nationally. The sales were down across the country because African Americans had said through social media, through urban radio, that people should stay out of the malls as long as the police are not respecting our right to exist, to due process. It's having an impact on the bottom line of the system. This week, Rahm Emanuel, the former chief of staff under Barack Obama and now the mayor of Chicago, announced the forced resignation of Chicago's police superintendent and also the establishment of a task force. Now, what real impact this is going to have in the long run, of course, may not be very much, but it shows that even with limited organization, the situation is so critical and that the overall system inside the United States is so fragile now in terms of its economic status. I mean, we hear a lot of propaganda about the recession being over and about the recovery being strong. But if we look at the actual data, and even some of the leading periodicals in the financial community know that the so-called recovery is extremely, extremely fragile. And that any extended racial explosion or outbreak of unrest in key urban areas across the United States could be devastating, not only to the image of the United States, but also to the overall social stability of the country.
I wanted to ask just maybe if you could comment about perhaps less spectacular forms of racial violence. I mean, not necessarily police killings, but you know, more subtle forms, such as you know maybe the power dynamics in the classroom, portrayals in the media, maybe representation in the labor force, and so on. Are there things that you would advise the movement to pay attention to that may not make the headline news, as it were?
There have been attacks on public education in urban areas. The lessening of funding by the federal government as well as state governments for education in urban areas, the massive laying off of teachers, the charterization of public schools, the attacks on teachers' unions, also the lessening of federal revenue-sharing monies coming into the cities, causing the closing of recreational centers, the privatization of municipal services, the forced bankruptcy of the city of Detroit in 2013 and 2014 was heavily racially oriented, the whole approach. Detroit is the largest populated African-American municipality in the United States. It has a tremendous history of African-American civil rights, black empowerment, also labor rights. Many of the organizations in the 20th century were started in Detroit. The Nation of Islam was started here. The Republic of New Africa was started in Detroit. The League of Revolutionary Black Workers was started in Detroit. Detroit had the largest urban rebellion during 1967, prior to any other time in the history of the United States. So it's not an accident that cities like Detroit, cities like Chicago are being targeted for these privatization efforts and efforts to further disempower oppressed people.
Okay, I just want to maybe conclude with one last question, and you kind of alluded to it with your comments about King moving in a more radical direction toward the end of his life. And that has to do with that umbrella, that capitalist imperialist order that's, overseeing all of this. Can racial justice in America be successful attained within that capitalist imperialist order, or must that structure by necessity be toppled?
I believe that the U.S. has to transform economically and politically out of the capitalist imperialist system into socialism. And I think that that is the only way you can really tackle this problem. The current system being structured the way it is cannot, at this point, institute the type of reforms that were even carried out 50 years ago during the 1960s, where after the Detroit Rebellion in 1967, Ford Motor Company set up hiring centers in black communities where they brought in thousands of people to work. No multinational corporation right now inside the United States is in a position to hire tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, or even millions of people who are unemployed or underemployed. So this is the major contradiction that we face right now, that the system is such that it cannot effectively reform itself, even under massive pressure. So I think that the next step will be a further erosion of the stability of the system, and that has to be matched by the degree of organization and coordination and mobilization on the part of the oppressed, along with all people who are for fundamental change, to bring about a new era in U.S. history.
Well, Abayomi Azikiwe, I really appreciate your sharing your thoughts and insights with us on this very special and topical subject. Thank you for joining us.
And thank you.
We've been joined by the editor of Pan-African Newswire, Abayomi Azikiwe. He's an outspoken and frequent commentator on issues of African and world affairs. Many of his essays are published at the Global Research website. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.